Okay. I'd like to welcome everybody to this, the ninth meeting of the Master Plan Science Advisory Team for the Marine Life Protection Act process. My name is Eric Bjorkstead. I'm the co-chair, along with Ron LaValle and Mark Carr. As is usual, we'll go around the table here and offer our introductions for the record. If we could start maybe with Steve over there.
Steve Murray from California State University, Fullerton.
Don Goley from Humboldt State University.
Dominic Gregorio from the State Water Board.
Stephen Morgan, UC Davis and Bodega Marine Laboratory.
Craig Strong, Crescent Coastal Research.
Karina Nielsen, Sonoma State University.
Larry Allen, Cal State Northridge.
Emily Sarman, UC Santa Cruz and the MLPA Initiative.
Seth Miller, Science Advisory Team Assistant.
Dominique Monnier, MLPA Initiative.
Ken Wiseman, MLPA Initiative.
Mark Carr, University of California, Santa Cruz.
Eric Bjorkstead, National Marine Fisheries Service and HSU Fisheries.
Ron LaValle from Mad River Biologist.
Michael Pearl from the Department of Fish and Game, support staff.
Sati Arame, MLPA and
Jason Vasquez, California Department of Fish and Game.
Tom Mason, California Department of Fish and Game.
Adam Frimidig, Department of Fish and Game.
And Becky Yoda, Habitat Conservation Manager, Department of Fish and Game.
Okay, welcome everybody. Today and tomorrow we have a full but hopefully efficient agenda to consider a number of elements of the evaluation process that we, as the Science Advisory Team, have been applying to the MPA proposals, or in this case, proposal. We'll be considering Science Advisory Team responses to science questions and then moving into evaluations of the Round 3 North Coast Regional Stakeholder Group MPA proposal. That will lead us into, also we'll have a period today in, at around 3:35 or so, give or take, for public comment, general to the Science Advisory Team's work and MLPA issues. However, many of the things that we're going to be discussing over the course of the next day and a half are items on which we'll be taking SAT decisions, votes, which bring the need for opportunity for public comment specific to those items. So we'll be doing that too, just to give everybody a heads up. With that, unless there are any specific questions from the team or anything that I forgot to mention, I think we should just jump right in and get going. Hearing none. So we're going to have two updates on the North Coast process for the MLPA initiative. First from Ken Wiseman on the on how it's going. So Ken, please.
I think that probably the greatest thing is you all realize is we have the unique position of having just one stakeholder proposal before you. And although we always say in the MLPA initiative process we don't do perfect, I think this is nothing short of phenomenal that you've had the community be able to pull together and come up with geographies they can support. You may be helping interpret how that looks and what it is and discussing where it is, but on behalf of Chair Gustafson, she asked that I make sure, you know, we recognize what the stakeholders have accomplished here and the vast array of stakeholders. As you know, you're usually looking at two or three proposals because, and you're comparing the maps. We're looking at one because this is a group of communities that came together and said, this is what we think is best for our area. We think we've come close to the guidelines, but this is what we think is best to put forward and to try to sort out the challenge of the tribal issues, which we in many ways can't sort out in this process, but which we can recognize and support. At the same time, the uniqueness of this area. And from a staff standpoint, I think we've all been really pleased coming to this kind of a community process after the very contentious and ongoing process in Southern California, where we weren't able to pull together as well as the folks in the North Coast did. And that's You know, as we get into all the details of what we're doing and how you might like this better than that, I don't want to lose sight of what a fabulous accomplishment is on behalf of the communities and behalf of, I think, good policy and good government to come together as they have, very different people from the conservation community, from the fishing communities, from local governments, and to really say we can live with this and we think this is best for our community. That's a powerful statement, and I know that we want to recognize that, how unique that is, how special that is, and then work with the science team to make sure that is as good as it can be, and talk about what the options are for the task force. But I know the task force is, many of them who've been in this since the beginning, always, you know, look forward to what they thought was mission impossible, to come up with one proposal, and this group has done that. So we want to celebrate that, and thank you all for all your continued work, and as we look at options, I think the, you know, the science has always been advisory and so important to our process. But I think because you're only looking at one proposal, there may be some opportunity to make some comment that will be helpful and help the Blue Ribbon Task Force in their deliberative process, because we're not comparing things. So you might talk about, is this, you know, that's not that big a deal, or, gee, I think it's a big deal because this is the kind of information that the task force would like to hear from you, because they're looking at just one proposal, and they really want to respect the community, but they want to make it as consistent with what's happened in the past and all the work that you've done. So I think the kind of commentary and discussion, if you can keep that in mind as we're going through this, will be very helpful to inform the process and make it the best it can be.
Great. Thanks, Ken. Any quick questions for Ken on that update? If not, I would like to ask Satie to update us on work from the tribal work group and tribal issues in the MLPA.
Hello. Thank you very much. I would like to give an update from the SAT tribal work group and related to the questions that have been revolving around tribal uses in this area. And the SAT tribal work group has, over the last 5 months, been working with staff on outreach to North Coast tribes and tribal communities. And the tribes and tribal communities provided comments and input to the process after the round three maps were released. And a list of proposed uses and gear types was given to the regional stakeholder group at their meeting in July. And that was revised slightly, but in minor ways, just for clarification, for the meeting in August. And that wealth of information that was contributed by North Coast tribes and tribal communities played an important role in the RSG's planning process. And so if I could get up PowerPoint presentation F1, we're just going to do a quick sneak preview of slides 4, beginning with slides 4 and 5. Great, thank you. So this is a presentation that you'll see a little bit later. Dominique Monnier is going to give this overview, but I wanted to give you a sense of how the input from North Coast tribes was integrated into the round three proposal. And the North Coast Regional Stakeholder Group designed the MPAs to the extent possible to avoid tribal use areas where it was not possible, and there were many places where there was tribal use, but the NCRSG was interested in putting an MPA there. They used the input to accommodate tribal uses to the extent possible in that area, and I'll talk about that in a minute. They also adopted a motion at that meeting that that traditional tribal uses should continue in all the proposed MPAs at such time in the future when the state of California takes action to do so. That's not a proposal to change the current designations or proposed allowed uses, but it's an intent by the regional stakeholder group, and I'll read it directly here. The NCRSG proposes that the following language be included in the MPA regulations. all California Indian tribal traditional non-commercial fishing, gathering, and harvesting for subsistence, ceremonial, or stewardship purposes shall be uses that are exercised by the members of California Indian tribes and tribal communities. And the intent of the NCRSG was to put that language into the other design considerations for their Round 3 proposal. And so you'll see that with every proposed MPA that goes forward. And it's their intent. It may not be what their proposed allowed uses are currently. So at some point in the future, there may be some change or resolution that would allow this to happen in all those MPAs that are proposed. But at the moment, the NCRSG designated a variety of different types of MPAs with certain proposed allowed uses. So I just want to go to slide 5. To explain what kinds of designations were used. So state marine reserves were used in several places, and they do not allow consumptive uses. There's, you can go in and enjoy the area, but not take anything out. The NCRSG identified species and gear types for activities that were intended for all users in state marine conservation areas, parks, and recreational management areas, or SMRMAs. And those uses were proposed throughout the many different MPAs that were proposed. They were at moderate high level of protection or above in most cases, with two exceptions. At Big River Estuary State Marine Park, there was a proposal to allow surf perch by hook and line from shore. And at Navarro River Estuary, there was a proposal to include salmon by hook and line. And those activities fall below moderate high. But for the most part, the uses intended for all users were at the moderate high level and above. Next, the North Coast Regional Stakeholder Group identified the conservation areas, parks, and SMRMAs where they intended to accommodate traditional tribal uses. But they didn't identify the specific species or gear types at their meeting. They directed staff to work with the Blue Ribbon Task Force and the tribes to bring that information into the process as appropriate. And so the staff identified the list of species and gear types from for each MPA that was intended to accommodate tribal uses based on that input that we received from North Coast tribes and tribal communities. And so if there was MPA-specific information provided, like there was a list specifically for the Viscano area, we incorporated that. There were some exceptions where a specific list was not available, for example, at Redding Rock. And at Redding Rock, we incorporated all of the uses that were proposed anywhere in the study region. So a comprehensive list was used. And so because of the variety of, I should say one more thing before we go on, that those uses are open to all users. They are classified as recreational uses, open to all users, but the intention of the regional stakeholder group was to accommodate traditional tribal uses with those. And you'll see these in the description of MPA's document, and they're listed as recreational uses intended to accommodate tribal uses. You'll also see commercial uses or recreational uses intended for all users listed. And I would like to make one more observation that because of the breadth of these activities, there are a variety of different activities proposed, the levels of protection fell below moderate high in many cases, and some of them were low and moderate low. And so that's something that you'll be exploring and thinking about more as you go through the proposal. And finally, the list of proposed uses from North Coast tribes and tribal communities included a wide array of uses. Some of those were terrestrial uses or in the freshwater environment, and some of them were not legal uses under current state law. And so we had to work with the Department of Fish and Game to identify only legal uses in the marine environment. And those are the ones that you see included in the description of MPA's document under a proposed allowed take. Finally, the uses that were not incorporated into the round three proposal are listed in the appendix to that document so that you can see which species were pulled out but were recommended for proposed use by tribes and tribal communities. So that's my quick summary of how this information was brought into the process. And now I will turn it back to Eric for the next agenda item.
Thanks, Satie. Just to clarify, too, the way that this is brought into each evaluation will be revisited at each evaluation because there are, for instance, the bioeconomic modeling had to treat these regulations in one way, size and spacing in a slightly different way. So we'll be revisiting this and reminding us all how this was brought into the evaluations at each phase. Any quick questions for Satie on this? Okay. We're going to move now into two items that are for SAT consideration of the design guidelines and evaluation methods for the North Coast Study Region. We'll first have a presentation regarding new levels of protection that have come out of these kind of lists that had to be designated. I'm not sure, is Emily or are you giving that? Okay, Mark will give that. And then Dominic will also give us an update or a review and discussion of the SAT evaluation methods for water quality, I guess. It's not actually listed here, but for water quality. Both of these will require SAT action, some kind of vote, and we'll either take them separately or together, depending on how the discussion proceeds. But with that, I believe we're going to see one. Presentation C1, and I'm going to let Mark take it away when that comes up.
Yep. How cool is that? Come on.
Yeah.
We're good to go? Okay, so let me preface this presentation with what we are hoping to get out of this section of the meeting, and the first is to have a discussion among the full SAT and a potential approval, if possible, if everybody's comfortable, with the recommended levels of protection designation that the level of protection working group has generated to date. Okay. And then, aside from considering and potentially affirming those levels of protection, remember there's also the associated text that goes into the evaluation report document. And that written text has yet to be made available, I think, to everybody on the SAT, and more importantly, to the public as well. So one consideration, if we can revisit it at the end of this, is whether we want to possibly consider approving the written text tomorrow after people have had time, or to give the public even further time to consider what that text, holding off until the next conference call. Okay? So the first three slides are all background material. Remember that the process for generating these levels of protection involved this conceptual decision tree that you're all familiar with, that we run each potential proposed use down through in order to get to some category of level of protection at the bottom. Remember that in the process of applying that model, we make three major assumptions. The first is that any extractive or proposed extractive activity can occur locally to the maximum extent that's allowed by current state and federal regulations. For the comparison of how a proposed activity alters an ecosystem, we compare that with an unharvested system, which is assumed to be a marine reserve that, in fact, is successful in eliminating the fishing and other extractive uses. And then finally, recall that we consider each of these uses in isolation. We don't have the capacity to date to consider the cumulative effects of multiple proposed uses. The reason we're visiting some of these new LOPs is because since the last SAT meeting, We've received input from the North Coast tribes and tribal communities on their uses, particular species and methods of take, that has now allowed us to identify particular species and gear types, which then we can apply a potential level of protection. This information then is used to identify recreational take, right, that's open to all recreational users, that it allows or accommodates that tribal take. And then finally, the result of this was a number of new levels of protection that the SAT working group generated that have been used in the development of the round three evaluations, which you will be exposed to tomorrow. So the first two slides are those new levels of protection. And we first consider those that generated high and moderate high. So some of these are highlighted in blue. Some of them are otherwise just underlined. The underlined text indicates those that are newly assigned levels of protection. The blue indicates those that we've drafted some of the initial text, descriptive text, for the rationale for those. So I'd like to quickly run down through these levels of protection. This is for the first two higher categories, high and moderate high, and open that for discussion. And I'll give you some initial rationale for how these particular species intake ended up in these levels of protection. So you see the first one that's new is other pelagic fin fish taken by hook and line or trawl in waters greater than 50 meters depth. And with the rationale there, as well as many in that high level, is based on two key things, the transiency of those species in the MPA, and then secondly, the consideration for potential incidental take of other species, right? Those are primarily the two key considerations that lead us to these higher levels of protection. So the other pelagic finfish, as well as pelagic finfish taken by spearfishing, Pacific lamprey, and then the eulachon, which is a smelt-like species, and then finally non-living shells. For all those finfish species, they're all transient species, and also have minimal incidental take associated with those. And so that's why those groups of species, the other pelagic fin fishes, especially those taken by spearfishing, as well as the lamprey and the eulachon, are considered largely very transient species along the coastline. The eulachon in particular, although it's smelt-like, is a species that, like salmon, is anadromous, like salmon and lamprey, is anadromous and is known to move great distances once it gets out into the open ocean, as opposed to other coastal nearshore smelt species. So that is the basis for the high-level designations for these. For the moderate high, you see that we've added and other pelagic fin fish involving trolling in waters less than 50 meters depth. Right. So remember, there's the distinction of trolling in deeper or less than 50 meters depth, because some of these propose that activity in less than 50 meter. They drop down to the moderate high level of designation. The other that's new is those elasmobranchs, the sharks, skates, and rays that are taken by a wide variety of uses, hook and line, spear, harpoon, bow and arrow, in non-estuarine waters, right, along the open coast. And then finally, trout, except steelhead rainbow trout taken by hook and line, likewise along the open coast. So for the shark, skates, and rays, again, transient species, all but the hook and line gear type are very specific, very targeted, and have a low level of a low potential for incidental take. However, on further consideration, the hook and line take of these species is not much different than, say, hook and line for any other bottom fish, like flatfishes, regardless of the mobility of the species. So one suggestion I would have in the modification of this level of designation is that the shark skates and rays taken by hook and line only drop down to the moderate level of protection, whereas all the other very specific ways of taking these species stay up at that moderate high level of protection. And then again, trout are, again, like other salmonids, are thought to be very transient through the nearshore marine environment. So before we leave this this slide, we can open it to discussion. Or do you want me to get through the whole thing and revisit these? I think. Okay. The next level includes the moderate, low, and low. And again, you can see the new ones, for example, are flounder, the flatfish at the moderate level, flounders, soles, turbot, and sand dabs by hook and line. And then also salmon and other pelagic fin fish, hook and line in waters less than 50 meters depth, and then white sturgeon by hook and line, and turbot snails by hand. Let me see if I can get to notes on that. So the at that moderate level, again, the idea, like I just commented on for what was the species up above, the elasmobranchs, the skate rays, those species are transient. However, take of those species in an MPA with hook and line increases the likelihood of taking other more resident species incidentally, hence the moderate level of designation. The salmon and other pelagic fin fish, hook and line in waters shallower than 50 meters, same argument, that again, although they are transient, their take by hook and line enhances the potential incidental take of more resident species. White sturgeon by hook and line, the same concept that, again, although it's highly transient in coastal waters, fishing for it near the bottom would also influence enhance the incidental take of other species. And then turbot snails by hand is an interesting one, that ended up being at the moderate level based on the fact that you certainly will alter the abundance of that species within a marine protected area, but its ecological role, the ecosystem-wide impact of the removal of that species is thought not to be that significant relative to other species. The next level down is moderate low, and you see that we've added sculpins, California moray eels, and wolf eels. You notice that California moray eels are added in here just for a statewide context, right? They don't occur up in the North Coast region. But while we're considering wolf eels, we thought we'd also take into consideration California moray eels that might be taken by these methods in other study regions. You'll notice again that it allows hook and line take for these species. And then based on their ecological role, the fact that they're largely residential with limited mobility, then they're likely to alter the abundance of these species and their functional role in the ecosystems, hence the moderate low designation. And then there's finfish, hook and line, and spear fishing. That's open, right, from either shore or from vessel. And so for the same rationale, now you have the potential of taking resident fin fish and altering their abundance and ecological role in the system, and as well as increasing incidental take through hook and line take. And then the shark skates and rays, hook and line, as well as these other take in estuarine waters as opposed to open coastal waters. And the concern here is that when these species occupy estuarine waters, they're probably having a more concentrated effect on the estuarine ecosystem. But more importantly, the use of these species of estuarine waters is often, if not almost always, associated with breeding activities and aggregations. And there's good evidence that there's strong site fidelity for some of these species. So as a consequence, by removing individuals in that environment, you have a much greater likelihood of altering their overall abundance in that environment for the long term, as opposed to taking them when they're transient in open waters. So that's why the lower level of designation for these species when they're proposed to be taken in estuarine waters. Limpets, unlike turbid snails, for which hand harvest has been proposed, again, you're likely to alter the abundance of those species, like turbid snails, but more importantly, there is evidence in the ecological literature that limpets play a potentially greater role in altering and structuring a rocky intertidal ecosystem by their maintenance of areas and altering the relative abundance of other species. So that was the rationale for those two gastropods falling into two different levels of protection. Octopus and crabs, because they, again, are more residential, and we know that they have important ecological functions in these near-shore ecosystems. Then finally, down at the lowest level of protection, you see native oysters by hand harvest, shrimp by hand harvest, and other marine invertebrates generically by hand harvest, as well as marine algae. And again, the reason that these all fell into that lowest level is always because they're thought to be important habitat formers that other species use, including the shrimps in estuarine waters because of the association of other species with the tubes that they create. And so that's the rationale for all those species, from the algae, the oysters, shrimp, and other invertebrates that are potentially producing habitat for other species. And the rest of the presentation is simply examples of how species like lamprey and the limpets were run through the decision tree to get to where... Sorry, that's not going to work, is it? Previous. To get to where? What happened to previous here? There we are. Let me get to another previous. And one more. So I want to emphasize that two things, okay, and this is very important for context for these discussions. First of all of these new level of protections that we are considering now do not alter the levels that were designated for the round three evaluations. And that's because other proposed species and gear types drove the level of protection designations for the MPAs that were proposed. So these decisions now are not going to affect the evaluations that we're going to discuss. However, we do need to move sooner than later in identifying these levels of protections for these proposed activities because in response to the round three evaluations, there may be proposed modifications of take or use in a marine protected area. And to identify what the consequence of that alteration in use has on the overall level of protection of an MPA, we need to know these levels of protection designations. And then finally, as I mentioned, we can hold off on the text and decide later whether we want to consider that tomorrow or later at the next meeting. That's it for me.
Okay, thanks, Mark. Let's go ahead and have discussion from the SAT. Put up your cards, or I'll just start jumping in. I'll start with Steve at the end, and we'll work our way down.
So, Mark, I have a question on the terminology with respect to algae.
Mm-hmm.
On moderate, moderate, low, and low. And I guess I have two questions. First is there's this grouping called turf algae.
Right.
And, you know, when I look at the use of turf, and I know we've been talking about this for a while. I don't know that maybe I should have caught this earlier. But, you know, when you have Chondrocanthus exasperata, this is a good size seaweed. And, you know, I don't know that anybody thinks of that as being a turf-forming algae. And then the other thing, when you come down to this other group, it says marine algae. It's just this big group. This is all the other species? Is that the idea?
Essentially, yeah.
Yeah. So is there a particular reason? I mean, when we look at my concept anyway of turf algae, these are things that you can harvest and they'll grow back very fast and so on. Certainly, something like a Chondrocanthus, it is really going to depend, I think, on the way in which this is removed. But I wouldn't put it in the same category. I don't know if Karina wants to chip in on that or not, but I wouldn't equate it with ulvas and porphyras and the other things that are in that group. So
for two reasons. One is that it's not as ephemeral as the other species, possibly. And do you think that the physical structure is more likely to afford habitat for other species?
I do.
Okay. Karina, do you?
I could speak just because I was in on some of those conversations. And I'm not the turf algae, I think, may have come out through conversations between intertidal and subtidal ecologists and their perception of turf versus canopy forming. Do you know what I'm saying? So I think just there was some conversations about that. I haven't been totally comfortable with that name convention, but I kind of understand conceptually what it means.
Mm-hmm.
And
species.
I think a lot of the concern through the LOP charts, Steve, was about their formation of habitat and food for smaller invertebrates, maybe not the effects of harvesting per se. We went through it pretty rigorously, and those were sort of the topics that came up, as mm-hmm. I recall.
So is there a proposal on the board, you think, to alter the species that constitute the turf algae or to change the designation of turf algae as a whole? He's thinking.
Well, there are two parts to this for mm-hmm. me. First is the terminology. So you've got four entities here, and they're grouped under this thing called turf algae. So the terminology uh-huh. doesn't sit well with me.
Hey,
but a more important question, really, mm-hmm. is whether these four entities that are listed here, harvesting them intertidally by hand, across the board equates with this moderate level of protection. And I assume that group, you know, hashed that over pretty thoroughly. No one's going to get too excited about this, except, you know, it is nice when you look at things that those names match up with what the scientific literature would file as turf. And that wouldn't be a turf.
Chondrocanthus, specifically. Gotcha. And otherwise, that one proposal is to extract Chondrocanthus from that group and move it down with the others. Is it correct?
I would only offer that if the folks who decided that Chondrocanthus belonged into that group would like to argue that it, in fact, harvesting it does allow it to fit into that mm-hmm. moderate level of protection.
And then the second consideration is the nomenclature.
Right.
And do you have a thought of a more descriptive term?
You have a pretty mixed bag here.
Yeah. I don't know.
Steven, could I just originally we had canopy forming and non-canopy forming that was the original grouping. I remember that conversation, and people were inclined in the conversation to have a more descriptive name than non-canopy forming for the remaining species. But for whatever reason, we settled on turf as a nomenclature, mm-hmm. turf forming. It doesn't necessarily sit well with me, that description. So, but it was more about dividing canopy versus non-canopy forming in an ecological context of the importance of that structure. So,
what you really could do, you just selected marine algae, period. You got them listed. You got to go there and look to see what they are anyway.
And these species, I do think, are more targeted. Is that correct, Karina?
The ones, I think, that are specifically named are ones that have been are known to be commercially taken.
Right.
Right.
Okay, can I just interrupt here? So there's no question, or is there any debate regarding the placement of the species themselves in location, because otherwise we're just talking about kind of semantics. how we clear up the semantics.
You know, I'll defer to the group that elected to put Chondrocanthus into that category. I won't.
Okay, so, but does that? I mean, do you have any? Regardless of what group it is, if you were to list all four species separately in the table, they're in the right place. That's the question.
Right. In the moderate low level. I'm sorry, in the moderate level.
So I'm going to toss that to you.
Okay.
I'm going to have to... Could we talk about this a little bit more offline, only in part because we had a fairly extensive discussion at the time, and it was quite a while ago, and I would like to just refresh my memory on some of the rationale, but I feel like we pretty robustly discussed each of those and the evidence for them and the literature that supported their designation. I feel pretty comfortable that we had a robust discussion, but I'd be willing to discuss it with you offline a little more before making a call.
Give us a minute or two, and we'll sort that out.
Okay. Let's move down to Stephen.
Yeah, I was just curious if you could explain how redtail and shiner surf perch wound up in different levels of protection.
Let me see where they are again. So shiner at the moderate low level and redtail are higher. And I think that's largely based on our impression of their relative mobility, transiency. Shiners, there's lots of evidence that they are quite residential. Redtail, there's evidence in the literature that suggests that they're more mobile. And so I think that's the fundamental distinction.
Good, thanks.
Thought was with the elasmobranchs of the take of the fish themselves, because as we know, they're really slow reproducing and K-selected, and so I recognize the rationale of that they're mobile for the most part when they're not in estuaries, but they are important elements of the ecosystem, and they're very easily fished out, so I'm just a little concerned with, the assumption that these LLPs are developed with the idea of maximum take under law, mm-hmm. and then turning around and saying that these are at a moderate high level. That's more of a comment than a question, maybe?
Sure. No, it's a good point, and we actually discussed that at length because we recognize that those species, because of their low reproductive rate, their viviparity, or egg production, are clearly very vulnerable to overfishing. There's evidence for that up and down the coast already. But what we thought is that despite that, the issue is what's the impact to the ecosystem at within the MPA. And the bottom line is, frankly, that recognition that you're describing needs to be more of a statewide regulation as opposed to whether you affect their abundance just outside of the MPA or inside, or take them inside the MPA. The consequence ultimately is the same. So, yeah, believe me, we're very concerned about that.
Yeah, staying on the elasobranchs, I want to return to the moderate high. Now, you mentioned that you thought one of those categories should be rotated down to moderate. Is that the hook and line?
That's hook and line because of the incidental take.
Well, is it going to be? I mean, is that?
Well, that's
because I would argue that it should because of the argument that whenever we're dealing with hook and line fishing in shallow water, it's the bycatch, as you pointed out.
Right on.
So I would argue that you can leave the spearing and all that directed stuff there, but I would say that we need to move. And I thought we had in our earlier discussions. Yeah. I thought the hook and line was in the moderate category.
Yeah, maybe we missed moving it, but. But so if we were to approve some of these LOPs, that one would be amended as such.
Yeah, I would support that.
Any other comments?
I just have a question for Larry on that. I mean, given the I'm just curious, what species are we talking about in terms of bycatch? Because sharks, I mean, when I think about fishing for sharks and bat rays and stuff like that, you know, you're over soft bottom, you're using big hooks. It's not like you're catching sand dabs as bycatch. So I'm just, you know, just want to flesh that out a little bit.
You do catch sand dabs as bycatch.
That's true, you do.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing what they can get in their mouth.
Yeah. But, you know, pretty much anything that's associated with the sand or the even rock-sand interfaces can be caught. When you're fishing in shallow water, and a number of species, rockfishes, lingcod, for instance, juvenile, so it's a bycatch issue. When you get shallow, get out beyond 50 meters or 30 meters, like we did in the south. I think it's a moot point. But
okay, just want to clarify that. Are there any other questions or comments from the SAT? Can we have somebody chase Stephen and Karina down so that we can? You try to get the algae question nailed down, because otherwise that does throw a bit of a delay into our proceedings here.
The the phycology working group has reconvened.
You're looking at me, right? You know, we phycologists have tried to educate some of you folks for years and years. And have failed miserably. But, what I'd like to do is I'd like to defer this one issue just for some more discussion. I think everything else is fine, good. This is one issue, and I don't want to, I don't want to just do something quickly. But I will say this. The way this is treated, it would be like taking a shark and tuna and saying they're the same things.
Uh-huh.
And you all wouldn't do that. So there are a whole lot of marine algae that are functionally equivalent to chondrocanthus that are down there in the lowest level of protection.
Mm-hmm.
So scientifically it doesn't fit that one should be here and the other should be there. You see what I'm saying?
Yep.
So let's do everything else, and we'll talk a little more about that.
Yeah,
one
and that's
issue.
Fine. You know, if we can move forward on all the others.
Yeah, everything.
Groups,
everything. I'm happy with everything else.
I think it would be important before we leave that particular topic, though, so that it's not ambiguous to the stakeholder groups, that any change in the level of designation would still remain down in that moderate to moderate low designation,
correct.
Right?
Correct.
And not higher.
Correct.
Emily had a...
Okay, Emily has a... different topic. Go ahead, Emily, and then we'll come back.
Yeah, I just had a quick point to add about the sharks, that although there's that general category of sharks, skates, and rays, which would include bat rays and leopard sharks and those kind of things, and any shark, skate, or ray, there's also a bunch of pelagic sharks that are in the pelagic finfish category. So those are kind of...
Right. Separately.
Separated out.
Let's go to
Karina.
Real Karina, and we'll come to Steve.
Okay. Since I left the room, I'm not sure where we're up to, but I had a concern about the differentiation between the turbid snails and the limpet designation.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And I actually don't agree with where the turbid snails are. They should not be. They are equally important, in my opinion, and I'd have to work through the tree as limpets in terms of their impact on the community. So mm-hmm. I'm not clear why they're at a higher level of protection than the limpets, to be perfectly honest.
Sure. And again, I think the only rationale there was that there was little evidence in the literature suggesting that turbid snails were major drivers of community structure.
My dissertation on tide pools has ample. I know a lot, so I can certainly provide that published literature to you.
No, that's fine. I'm just giving you the reason, the rationale for where it ended up where they did. Yeah, I know.
I'm intimate with the turbid snails.
That's what I was afraid of.
I would also like to add one thing, in that the harvesting methods
by hand take,
and you know when they go out on those shallow reefs and completely walk all over everything when they're doing that, it's I think that has an element.
The other thing is age to maturity is long. You know, I mean, it's not something that matures at a young age. You know, it takes several years for them to be reproductive. So there's a couple of reasons to be a little bit more concerned, perhaps.
So would people be comfortable with the amendment to that designation of moving the turbid snails down to which level are you proposing? Moderate, low, with the limpets, right?
With the limpets. I just don't see any justification mm-hmm. for them being any different.
Gotcha. Could we comment on that? Or just to discuss that quickly, because we may resolve that rapidly as well. I think we're done. Does anybody disagree with Karina's proposal? Bunch of snail huggers. Okay. Okay. So I think we've got that amendment then identified as well. There's two amendments. One was the hook and line of the elasmobranchs. And the other was the moving of these guys. And then Stephen has something else.
I was just going to recommend, I think it might have been because of a grouping with eels, but monkey face, prickleback probably should have been included with moray and wolf eels.
Mm-hmm.
And rock.
So are they – they're not listed separately, are they? They just simply weren't listed.
They were
yet.
In previous lists, and I think they got subsumed into the eels, and then they got taken back out. But if you're going to list moray eel – which don't occur anywhere north of the Channel Islands. I think the ones that are of real importance in the north are the monkey face prickleback and the rock prickleback. Those are the ones that are taken in the intertidal and subtidal.
So that's a third amendment to add those two species to that list of eel-like species that are at the moderate low level of designation.
Okay, two questions on that. One, do we have a designation already associated with those fishes from previous times?
I would have thought they'd be at moderate.
I would have thought we did. And the reason I ask is because before we just stick them in there, they need to go through the tree to make sure that really fits. And I granted the ecology kind of is like, but we just want to make sure that's done.
You know, I was looking back through text from the North Central Coast, and I didn't find descriptive text about the monkey-faced prickleback, but I distinctly remember doing research on their movement patterns and finding that they do not move substantially and that they do play an important role in the ecosystem, which would support assigning them moderate low-level protection.
Any other comments on this? Okay, so where we stand currently is that we have the existing, what we just saw and have reviewed, table of LOPs with three amendments, one to put the turbid snails at the same designation as limpets, which is moderate low, I think. I'm not even going to try to guess the rest of these. Hook and line, elasmobranchs to be taken from moderate high to moderate or something like that, but to be moved down, mm-hmm. reflecting the bycatch issues in especially in shallow water, and to include the other intertidal eel-like fishes in with the California moray and the wolf eel. And then also we are deferring the algal designations to allow that to be parsed out a little more to everyone's satisfaction. Are there any other comments on that? Are there any major concerns on that? Okay, so we are at a point where we could be taking a taking a vote on this. Do we want to go ahead and proceed with taking public comment on this material specifically?
I think we should go ahead and do it. Great if we could.
Okay. So first, so we have two nodes, as we have had on in past science advisory team meetings. We have one in Crescent City, one in Fort Bragg. I would like to invite the folks who are playing host to those nodes to please figure out how many comments you have coming in and let us know. Is Kelly around or someone? All right, so Susan will be following up. And then while we await for that, that input, could we invite any public comments specific to the issue of these new LOP designations from the public that's here in Eureka? Looks like we have one comment coming up.
Hi, John Corbett, Yurok Tribe, and I need a clarification from the chairman. Is it on the LOPs that you're going to adopt or only the new ones at this point in time?
It will be on the new ones, the ones we were just discussed.
Okay, so later for the general LOP.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any comments from the other? Nothing. None from Crescent City. Anything from Fort Bragg? Okay.
Better hold off.
No comments from Fort Bragg.
You were ready to go.
Oh, okay. Actually, all right, Satie is going to clarify my answer, which means revise it extensively and be prepared to come up and comment.
So I'm not sure I understood the public comment correctly, but we are going to be asking the SAT to approve or modify as appropriate the new LOPs. We've already approved the other LOPs that are in the table, and I'm not sure that was conveyed. At some point in the future, at the next meeting, the SAT will be reviewing the supporting documentation as well for the new LOPs, but that many of those levels of protection already have been approved by the science team. And those are all those that are in black font, not underlined, or blue. So
those kind of aren't up for debate anymore.
Correct.
Okay. So let that guide whether you want to make your comment now or...
Well, I'll make it very succinct. I'll write you a letter. I thought if there were zero take, they weren't to be in the lowest level of protection, and Fish and Game Code 6750 and CCR 3010 puts the sea palm at zero take anywhere, any circumstance. And then we also had a question along the same lines. Is a listing under either the State or Federal Endangered Species Act considered zero take, or do you exclude it because there's incidental take in your highest level of protection?
So I think this is correct, is that with respect to Endangered Species Act, things can be delisted. So we're not considering that. Whether if they came back, then the take within MPAs would affect their place in the ecosystem there. CPOM?
With respect to CPOM, commercial take is allowed. It's recreational take that's prohibited.
Very good. Thanks. Okay, so here we are at motion time. Actually, we should have had the motion before public comment, but I'm requesting someone to make a motion or inviting a motion to approve the existing new LOPs with the amendments for turbid snail, hook and line elasmobranchs, and the placement of eels, excluding the algaes, intertidal algaes for now.
Algae. So moved.
Yes. Thank you.
Second. Alga, algae.
It's nicely done.
Yeah.
Second?
Oh, did you mention the bricklebacks? Yeah.
Yes, I got the motion, I got the correction, and I got the second. So, yes, we did. He so moved, and then pluralized me. So let's go ahead and have a show of hands in favor of the motion from the SAT. All in favor, raise your hands, please. Leave them up so we can count them. Any opposed? Any abstentions? Okay, that carries. Very good. We will now move on. How are we doing on time? 2:10. We'll now move on to Dominic is going to provide us an overview and a review of the evaluation methods for water quality analyses that have been done by the SAT, and we're going to be approving the methods and the document here, okay? Or considering approval of these. Go ahead, Dominic. Take it away. We need presentation D1 when you have a chance.
Okay. Thanks, Eric. I think this is really more of a sort of a house cleaning issue here. A while back, we had one of the questions was posed to the SAT that had to do with the effects of dredge spoil disposal. And so we answered that question. We had sort of an extensive answer to it, and that was approved by the SAT. And at that time, it was suggested, and everybody was pretty unanimous on the SAT that that it should be incorporated into the evaluation methods document. And at the last face-to-face SAT meeting, we hadn't actually gotten that prepared, and now we have. And so if you look at page 2 of the document, you'll see there there's a paragraph that's been added. There's also been a couple of other references to this same paragraph by using the term dredge spoil activities or disposal activities. But here's the main change right here, that the SAT identified two areas where dredge disposal occurs. Those were in the vicinity of Crescent City Harbor and Whalers Island, which is near there. And the second one is at the HOOD site, which stands for Humboldt Open Ocean Disposal Site. Now, the HOOD site is 3 miles off of the mouth of Humboldt Bay, so it's not really in state waters, but it does abut against state waters. And so any MPA that, let's say, would be suggested there or could be suggested there could have the effect of turbidity as a result of that location. So we simply incorporated the answer to that science question into the document for the evaluation methods. So that's really all I have to say about it. It's again, like I said, it was sort of a house cleaning type of thing.
Anything you'd like to say for the next 18 minutes of your time?
No, I think we'll probably make it up someplace else.
Okay, great. All right. Well, thanks very much for that, Dominic. Are there any questions from the SAT? Otherwise, if there are none, I'd like to invite a motion to just approve this final revision to this document. Have it from Ron.
Second.
Second from Stephen. We'll go ahead and invite public comment on this detail because we do have to take a vote. Are there any comments locally regarding this revision? I have no one able to. Is there anyone able to tell me whether there are comments from the nodes? Okay, so Crescent City or Fort Bragg, are there any comments regarding the revision to the water quality evaluation document, specifically the revision focusing on how dredge disposal sites are included in the document? If so, please, would someone say yes or no, please? Well, we're going to go ahead and proceed. This is a fairly minor point, and if something major, okay, a major issue arises, we will come back. In that case, a show of hands approving this revision.
I
Anyone opposed? Stephen, are you voting but twice? No. Any opposed? And any abstentions? Okay. Sounds like that carries as well. Okay. Thanks. Okay. We are now to we're going to shift to a review of the SAT responses to the various science questions that have come in. This will be briefing document E1. Seth, do you want this document up, or are you going to well, I'm going to turn it over to Seth. If he wants the document up, he can have it up. And Seth will lead us through the revisions, and then we'll have the discussion.
We can just put it up there. There's not these are draft responses to questions that were formulated by SAT work groups and then presented as draft responses that had not yet been approved by the full SAT during the August 30th RSG meeting. So we wanted to sort of get the word out as quickly as possible, but the RSG knew that these had not yet been voted on by the full SAT. So they've been sort of on the public record for almost 2 months now. So hopefully you've had some time to review them. I will say that there is one quick revision that's going to be made on question number 5. Will White emailed after I sent these out to you all. He had just some wording revisions to question 5 that don't change any of the content or anything, but he wanted that to be in there before it was put away and locked up forever. So I'm not going to run through these question by question, but if you guys have any comments or questions, it's pretty straightforward.
I have one possible minor revision to suggest to number 6, which is the question about how limited access points affect harvesting patterns and thus contribute to protection of coastal and marine ecosystems. And the final sentence says, if one believes that limited access severely restricts total fishing effort, one should put more weight on the modeling results, assuming conservative management. That's true. The revision I'd like to suggest is that if one believes that limited access severely restricts not so much total fishing effort, but the distribution of fishing effort, making it more concentrated near ports, then your answer is somewhere you need to do a little bit more there. I'm not sure exactly how to word it, but it would be if limited access severely affects the distribution of fishing effort, we would expect the effects of fishing to have a spatial pattern not captured in the current bioeconomic models. We would see greater depletion near ports or near access points and greater effective protection away from ports. We have not quantified that, but it's an important pattern, I think, to have noted in this answer. Yes, did you write any of that down, Seth?
I think I got almost all of it.
Okay.
If one believes that limited access severely restricts the distribution of fishing effort, we would expect the effects of fishing to have a spatial pattern not captured currently in the bioeconomic model, and we would expect depletion closer to ports. And
actually, I think that pretty much captures it.
Period.
That we would expect greater depletion closer to ports.
Or the likelihood of depletion to be greater.
So if one believes that limited access severely restricts the distribution of fishing effort, we would expect the effects of fishing to have a spatial pattern not captured currently in the bioeconomic model, and we would expect greater likelihood of depletion closer to ports.
Any further comments on that or any other any of the other science questions? Wow, when I said efficient agenda, I was like kind of tongue-in-cheek, but this is useful. In that case, with that one revision, I'm going to invite a motion that the SAT approve these as being more than draft draft responses and become the official response of the SAT to the RSG and the BRTF. If someone's comfortable so moving, or to be honest, and if someone has not done their homework, we can, you know, ask your neighbor to say, I'm not ready, and, you know, we'll disguise who you were, and we can defer this. But I'm hoping that folks have taken advantage of the opportunity to read these ahead of time.
I've done my homework, and I move that we adopt the answers to the science questions.
Great. Do I have a second for that? The phycologists have spoken. Jointly moved. Okay, so we will public comment specific to the answers the SAT is providing in response to the science questions that have been out and available for review. Are there any comments locally, and are there any comments from our two nodes? I don't know how we're able to. Do we have somebody actually in contact with these groups besides trying to? Okay, thanks. So are there any comments locally? I'm seeing none. Are they able to just, do they have an open channel to speak to us to say yes or no?
No comments from Fort Bragg.
Thank you. Woohoo! Is that you, Jim?
No comments from Crescent City.
Great. Thank you very much. Although your comments are welcome. Thanks for touching base. All right, then we will go ahead and take a vote. All in favor of approving these responses to the science questions? All opposed? Any abstentions? All right, we're finished with that. Thank you very much. Yeah, so we're going to continue to proceed right along with the agenda, and perhaps have a bit more time for public comment or a bit longer break when the time comes. Dominique, which presentations do you need up?
F1, and that will be followed by F3.
Okay, and Dominique's going to give us an overview of the existing proposal. Thank you.
Okay, so yes, I'm just going to walk through and give some highlights from the North Coast Regional Stakeholder Group Marine Protected Area proposal. So just looking at a quick timeline, in August 31st, the North Coast Regional Stakeholder Group came to agreement on a single proposal, and that is what we'll be hearing evaluations on today and tomorrow at this Science Advisory Team meeting. On October 25th and 26th, the Blue Ribbon Task Force will be meeting. This is where we are now. So in a couple weeks, the Blue Ribbon Task Force will be receiving all of the evaluations from the science team and the other evaluations from Department of Fish and Game and State Parks. And they will also have all the members from the North Coast Regional Stakeholder Group participating in that meeting. And then in November, there's another SAT meeting via webinar, and in February of next year is when we expect the Blue Ribbon Task Force to present their recommendation to the California Fish and Game Commission. So before I get into kind of walking through the proposal, let me give you some background information on round three. As I said, our North Coast Regional Stakeholder Group did come to agreement on a single proposal, and they also came to agreement on a separate recommendation for special closures, and I will talk about that next. So looking back at a lot of their key considerations during round three were reviewing some of the gaps from round two, and they addressed those that they believed were appropriate to address and could address, keeping in mind all of the other considerations and interests in the North Coast. Some of those were the soft 100 to 3,000 meter habitat in the northern bioregion and also the beaches habitat. And so I'll call out some of those places where they addressed those habitat gaps that they had seen in round two. And then there were also some gaps that they felt were that they were identified during round two and just felt that they could not address in their round three proposal for various reasons. And some examples of those are the estuary spacing, which was those gaps were introduced to them in round two, and they just felt that they wanted to concentrate on some of the other spacing gaps, and that wasn't the one they felt they could address in their proposal. And then also the beaches spacing gap in the southern bioregion, there the gap was a gap was introduced with the change at Stewart's Point. So the from their bioregion down, that gap increased due to the loss of the beaches replicate at Stewart's Point. And so that was a gap that that you'll still see in this round three proposal. And then these are just really quickly the two slides that Satie also already went through, I think, very clearly. And again, I'll be pointing out they did try very hard to avoid tribal use areas where it was possible, and where not, they have included those recreational uses that are intended to accommodate tribal uses. And they did adopt that motion that you'll see for all of the marine protected areas in their proposal, indicating their intent for tribal uses and how those can be addressed in the future. So again, this is just all of the state marine reserves you'll see do not allow consumptive uses. They did identify uses intended for all users in the conservation areas, parks, and state marine recreational management areas, the SMRMAs, and then requested that staff fill in those uses to intended to accommodate tribal uses. And as Satie said, that was based on staff worked based on input from the tribes and tribal communities that they received in round two and with Department of Fish and Game. And you'll only see legal uses in the marine environment included in this proposal. So another thing that we'll see is, in addition to the standard evaluation, we'll also see a supplemental evaluation. And the supplemental evaluation was requested by the Blue Ribbon Task Force to help provide them with additional information as they look at the round three proposal. And so our standard evaluation is just based on the science advisory team's methods for evaluating proposed MPAs that we've seen in the last two rounds. And then the supplemental evaluation is providing that additional information about marine protected areas that have those recreational uses that are intended only to accommodate traditional tribal activities but are open to all recreational users. And so as we walk through the presentations today and tomorrow, the methods for how that supplemental evaluation was addressed by each evaluation will be presented. I'm not going to go into them all right now. and so those evaluations that we'll be hearing about are habitat representation, habitat replication, MPA size and MPA spacing, bioeconomic modeling, marine birds and mammals. And just to call out that that is one of the SAT evaluations that specifically includes the special closures recommendation, and then the potential impacts to fisheries and the water quality. In addition to those science evaluations, there's a lot of other information and evaluations that are prepared for this round three proposal. Those include the overview and cluster maps, and the overview map is actually briefing document F2 for you today. The area charts by designation type and level of protection that we'll actually see in this presentation, and then the description of MPAs, consideration of existing MPAs, some information about the special closures, and then staff summaries and habitat calculations again for the proposal. And then the other evaluations that they'll see are on Goal 3, and then the feasibility analysis from the California Department of Fish and Game and the analysis from the from California State Parks. And all of that will be online down at that website down there. So looking at the single round three proposal and then proposal zero, those are the two that are on the plate, you'll see the North Coast Regional Stakeholder Marine Protected Area proposal is abbreviated as NCP, and that includes 17 marine protected areas, six of which are state marine reserves. The entire proposal encompasses about 13% of the study region, and 5% of that is in the state marine reserves. and then are looking at Proposal Zero, that included only 5 marine protected areas with 1 state marine reserve and covered 0.3% of the study region, with 0.2% of that being in the reserve. So this is just looking at the Round 3 proposal by designation type. And so the red is the state marine reserves, and you can see on the left-hand side that's the percent of study region area that's included. So as I said, there's 5% of that is in state marine reserves, and the rest is in conservation areas, state marine parks, and the SMRMAs. And then the hatch marking that you see over the top of that graph is indicating marine protected areas that include recreational take that is intended to accommodate tribal uses but is open to all recreational users. So you can see, of course, none of that is over the state marine reserves because those have no allowed take, but most of the state marine conservation areas do include recreational take that is intended to accommodate tribal uses. And then this is the proposal again, but now instead of being broken down by designation type, this is by level of protection. And so the very high level of protection is going to be the state marine reserves again. So you see that's also at 5% on the left-hand side. That's percent of the study region area. And then there's the one sort of a bluish, the moderate high. And so that's that conservation area that didn't include uses intended to accommodate tribal uses. And then the rest of the bar there is a moderate low and low, the green shading, and again with the marks to show that those are MPAs that include recreational take intended to accommodate tribal uses, but again open to all recreational users. So this is just, again, briefing document F2 for you, an overview map of the entire proposal, and this also includes the special closures on here for reference. So we'll get a little bit closer in and see what we're looking at. Starting in the north. This is the Pyramid Point Conservation Area and Point St. George Reef Offshore Conservation Area. And here, the Point St. George Reef Offshore Conservation Area is one of the areas where you see the NCRSG was trying to address some of those gaps that were brought up in round two. And so this offshore SMCA captures some of that deep, soft habitat that they had been missing and had a gap for. So that helps address that habitat spacing gap. And then Pyramid Point, they had a lot of discussions about this in conjunction with the False Klamath area, where there were a lot of the similar habitats. And so they chose to go with this conservation area at Pyramid Point, which had fewer economic impacts. And that does include a recreational take intended for all users and also intended for just to accommodate tribal uses. The Point St. George Reef Offshore SMCA is the only SMCA that does not include uses intended only to accommodate tribal uses. So the commercial and recreational uses there are intended for all users. And then moving south, we come to the cluster at Redding Rock, and this was a little bit of a shift from what we had seen in this area in round two. They've actually shifted the marine protected areas to the south from what we saw in round two. And they've used an inshore SMCA and offshore SMR design to be able to accommodate tribal uses on the inshore and then have that very high level of protection offshore. South from there, we come to Samoa SMCA. This one, again, they were looking at some of the gaps that they had in round two, and this SMCA addresses the beaches habitat gap that was in the north. So they're picking up that habitat here. It also includes rocky shores and soft 0 to 30 meter habitat. And it does include recreational uses that are intended only to accommodate tribes, but is meant to function as one of the backbone MPAs, as are the other MPAs we've seen so far. South Humboldt Bay, Smyrma, this is the only estuarine MPA that we have in the northern bioregion in the Round 3 proposal. And here, again, the NCRSG tried very hard to work with the habitats that they needed to capture and also to accommodate, to avoid tribal use areas where possible and then also accommodate those uses. And so they've done that by leaving this area open to the south. And then the only uses that are proposed in this MPA are recreational uses intended to accommodate tribal uses. And there's also, it's a Smyrma, the Smyrma designation, because waterfowl hunting is allowed. So moving down to the Punta Gorda region, we have three state marine reserves, all relatively close to each other. These probably looks pretty familiar. We saw a very similar design in round two in most of the draft proposals, in part because of the large amount of community input that the NCRSG has received from the communities in this area. And these are all, of course, functioning as backbone MPAs that are no take, though the NCRSG did express their intent to have these accommodate tribal uses when California is able to take that action to allow that kind of exclusive use. This is the Matole Canyon Reserve is the area where they're capturing that deep hard, that rare deep hard habitat. So these are key MPAs, and then the bioregion split is also within that Matole Canyon Reserve. So we're now moving into the southern bioregion. So Big Flat is a conservation area that, again, this is trying to address some of those habitat gaps. This one also addresses the beaches habitat gap that was seen between between Viscano and Samoa. So this is reducing that gap. And it allows uses, recreational and commercial uses intended for all users, and then also has some recreational uses that are intended just to accommodate tribal uses. Okay, Viscano SMCA is one of the preferred size MPAs. The only other preferred size was the cluster at Redding Rock. So these are the two preferred size MPAs in the proposal. It's the first replicate from the north of kelp and hard 0 to 30 meter habitat. So it's very important for reducing the gaps for those habitats. And it also reduces the spacing gap for the soft 100 to 3,000 meter habitat. And this allows salmon and Dungeness crab take for all users recreational and commercially, but then also has recreational take that's intended to accommodate tribal uses. Moving south from there, we come to the 10-mile cluster. So here again is an area where we're seeing a cluster that the NCRSG worked hard to accommodate, to avoid where possible those tribal use areas and then accommodate the uses where they needed to. So the conservation area at the bottom was very strategic to include the beach area and allow for recreational uses intended to accommodate tribes there. And then the reserve is, of course, no take. And it is one of the most efficient MPAs in the proposal, and that it captures a very high number of key habitats within a single MPA. And then to the right, you can see the green down in the lower right-hand corner there, the 10-mile estuary Smyrma. Again, there's that Smyrma designation because of waterfowl hunting. Other than that, there are no proposed allowed takes in that estuarine MPA. Then we move down to Point Cabrillo, another reserve. This is a modified existing marine protected area, and it's the only existing marine protected area that was maintained in the Round 3 proposal. It is a below minimum size MPA, and that's partially because it was established for Goal 3 purposes, so for research and education, and they're very interested in doing something with adaptive management. So this is primarily a Goal 3 State Marine Reserve. And then Big River State Marine Park, this is the only State Marine Park in the Round 3 proposal. It replicates the estuarine habitats, but it has a below moderate high level of protection due to the recreational uses here. That are intended for all users. So this is an area where they have only one of two areas where they have recreational take uses that drop the level of protection below moderate high that are not just intended for to accommodate tribal uses. And that's surf perch, hook and line from shore that's allowed, that's dropping that level of protection. And then the last MPA in the proposal is the Navarro River Estuary Smyrma. And again, that Smyrma designation because of the waterfowl hunting in the area. And it's a very small estuarine MPA, and that is in part because the NCRSG was trying hard to meet the feasibility guidelines for design from Department of Fish and Game. So it allows, salmon hook and line take for all, and that's intended for all users. So this is the other MPA where you have uses that drop the level of protection below moderate high because of uses intended for all users and not just intended for to accommodate tribal uses. So that's the Round 3 proposal. And as we move through the evaluations, just some useful feedback for the Blue Ribbon Task Force is to highlight key differences between the standard and supplemental evaluations. That supplemental evaluation, again, as I mentioned, was really to provide information for them. And so highlighting those differences is important. And then areas where science guidelines are met or where they are close to being met in the proposal, and then also, where they're difficult or not possible to meet. This was important in round two. Some of the examples are, the kelp spacing was hard to meet, and so that was important information for our stakeholder group to understand about and also our Blue Ribbon Task Force. And then, of course, highlighting which MPAs are playing key roles in meeting the various guidelines. And so looking ahead again, we'll be going over the round three evaluation results today and tomorrow at the October 25th and 26th Blue Ribbon Task Force meeting. They will be receiving those evaluation results. And there also will be participation from our North Coast Regional Stakeholder Group at that meeting. And then you will be meeting again via webinar on November 17th. And the Blue Ribbon Task Force will present their recommendation to the Fish and Game Commission in February. So I think that's it for the round three proposal. Are there any questions?
I have just one question and more of a clarification. Mm-hmm. On that bar chart that had the hash marks for LOP, that had the hash marks indicating where recreational uses that were intended only to accommodate tribal uses had changed the designation. If you were to... be able to remove the hash marks, say there was an accommodation within state law, those would all move up to moderate high or higher?
Yes.
Okay. Just wanted to make sure I understood that correctly.
Except for the two estuarine MPAs, the Big River SMPA and Navarro River Smyrma, but all the others.
Because they had specific open recreational uses, not just intended for tribal access,
yes,
right?
That's correct.
Craig?
Okay. Kind of a related thing. I'm just kind of curious as to why the BRTF asked for this supplemental evaluation. Is it, I guess what I'm asking, is it anticipated that we go through with our evaluation, and in the future, if there is a legal framework for accommodating tribal uses, then the MPA proposal will be modified so that uses for all recreational will drop out. Is that the case?
Punt that to Satie.
I may let someone else take that, yeah.
So I would just like to address the first part of your question, which is why the BRTF asked for this type of evaluation, and then I think I would turn it over to Melissa for further insight about future possibilities. But the first part is that the Blue Ribbon Task Force realized that if a wide variety of uses are proposed for all users to accommodate tribal use, then there's a possibility that some of those uses might fall below moderate high level of protection, that they made this determination at their meeting in July. So it was before the final proposal had been developed. But they anticipated that that could happen. And in that case, those marine protected areas fall out of the evaluations for size, spacing, and replication. And they really wanted to see what was inside those MPAs and how far apart they were and what the sizes were. And so they didn't want to lose that information in the round three evaluation, so they requested the supplemental evaluation. Because modeling and ecotrust evaluations of potential impacts to recreational and commercial fisheries are slightly different. They don't have a threshold below moderate high or above moderate high. They actually take the proposed regulations. And so those were done in a slightly different way, and the speakers will explain in detail how the supplemental evaluation was done.
Craig, unfortunately, my crystal ball is not working today, so I can't tell you what's going to happen in the future. However, we are aware that, and our stakeholder group, the regional stakeholder group, has been very supportive of the concept of traditional tribal activities being allowed to continue within marine protected areas. The state of California has said that it does not currently have the authority to do that, to only allow tribes and tribal communities to extract resources and not other users. So that's why we have the situation where the regulations, we are told, will have to be written to allow all recreational users, if in fact that's the pathway that folks take to, or the BRTF takes to accommodate tribal uses. It's entirely possible that in the future there would be some different interpretation by the administration or legislative action or congressional action or something that would allow traditional tribal activities to continue within MPAs. But that will take some effort on someone's part.
Any other questions regarding the overview?
I have a quick question. My understanding is that when the stakeholder groups proposed a state marine reserve, it excluded recreational and tribal use.
Yes.
Right, everything.
Yes.
But when you got to Punta Gorda region, you mentioned that those three state marine reserves were proposed with the intent that maybe in the future tribal use could be accommodated in those state marine reserves?
In the other design considerations, the regional stakeholder group highlighted that their intention across the whole proposal was really not to impede tribal uses. That was not their goal. So in those areas, they put in the state marine reserves, but and as Melissa just said, should there be that change in the future, should there be that allowance to be able to allow exclusive use rights for tribes, the stakeholder group wanted to make sure it was clear that they would like to see that occur in the reserves also. Mm-hmm. But yes, right now there is no take allowed in any of the reserves in the round three proposal. Clarify it.
Mm-hmm. Other questions from the SAT? Okay, very quick time check. Where are we?
I'm actually not done.
Oh.
That was just my first PowerPoint. get F3 up, please? This one will be faster. So, and this is, I'm just going to walk through really quickly the special closures recommendation from the North Coast Regional Stakeholder Group. So that's what we'll be looking at. Yes, thank you. Okay, so just a quick review of special closures. They are not a marine protected area designation, but they are designated by the California Fish and Game Commission, and they may offer additional geographically specific protection to marine species, such as seabirds and marine mammals. And these special closures can coincide with, overlap, or be completely separate from marine protected areas, and we will see one where there is some overlap with one of the proposed state marine reserves. And they may be designated as seasonal or year-round. We'll see both of those in the North Coast Regional Stakeholder Group recommendation. And they are, all of the special closures are designated as no access. So we had a special closures work group that was made up of members from our North Coast Regional Stakeholder Group and also members of the public. Specifically in round three, we had some folks from BLM join us. And that group was supported by staff. They met three times during round three. So they really put in a lot of time and deserve a huge thank you for all of the time and effort that they dedicated to helping to develop this recommendation. So that work group forwarded their recommendation to the North Coast Regional Stakeholder Group. And then the North Coast Regional Stakeholder Group took it from there. Just real quickly, Proposal Zero does not include any special closures, so there are no existing special closures in the North Coast Study Region. And again, this special closures recommendation is separate from the Round 3 NCRSGMPA proposal, but it is intended to accompany that proposal. So a quick overview of the special closures recommendation. It includes 7 special closure options. 2 are focused on marine mammal protection, and the other 5 are focused on marine bird protection. All of the special closures are suggested as 300-foot no-entry zones. In all but one case, this means entirely around a rock or group of rocks. We'll see in one area where it excludes part of the area around the rock because that would overlap onto a beach. 4 of the 7 special closures are seasonal closures, and they are all closed or proposed to be closed from March 1st to August 31st. And then in addition to these 7 special closure options, there is also a proposal for an alternative to special closures at Green Rock and Flatiron Rock. These were areas where there were important bird colonies on both of these rocks. Some people felt strongly that these were important areas to protect, but we also had the most of all the special closures in round 2, these 2 received the most public comment. And there was a lot of concern about boat safety and boats that travel close to these rocks to go back and forth to Trinidad Harbor. So the work group developed this proposal for an alternative to special closures, and that was adopted by the NCRSG also. And then, again, as I stated, the NCRSG wanted to be very clear that their intention is really not to impede traditional tribal uses. And so within special closures, recognizing that these are no entry zones for everyone, they did want to include that intent language. So if there is a change where there could be the exclusive use for within marine protected areas, that possibly something could be done similarly for special closures so that they wouldn't be impeding any of those tribal uses in the special closure areas. So again, this is just that overview map with the proposal and the special closures on it. And again, that's briefing document F2. This is a bit hard to see. So we'll start up at the north again. The northernmost special closure is at Southwest Seal Rock. This is proposed as a 300-foot year-round closure, and there's a stellar sea lion rookery, so that's the primary focus of this is to provide protection for that rookery. It's a little over 5 miles from the nearest point of land, and there are potential impacts to recreational and commercial fishers. It's my understanding this isn't the easiest place to get to, but when the weather is nice, people do go out there and fish. Next one down is Castle Rock. This, again, is a 300-foot year-round closure. Here, this is really because of the it's a major seabird breeding site. It's the largest one in the study region, possibly along the California coast. I know it's a very important one. And this on the rock itself is already, there's no public access on the island, so the no-entry zone will kind of extend that into the water, and there are potential impacts to kayakers and small boat fishers that use this area. But again, you know, about 120,000 birds use the rock as a breeding site, so it's a big one. Next down is False Klamath Rock. This one was proposed as a 300-foot seasonal closure, and again, the seasonal closure was partly to recognize that there is tribal use in this area and to try and leave that area open for as much of the year as possible. But it is closed for the bird breeding season from March 1st, or proposed to be closed from March 1st to August 31st. About 45,000 breeding seabirds that use this site, eight different species. Again, potential impacts to kayakers and small boat fishers. And then there is potential co-management opportunities with the Redwood National and State Parks, which are adjacent. Going south, we come to Sugarloaf Island. This is a 300-foot year-round closure. This is the other stellar sea lion rookery in the North Coast study region. So both of the stellar sea lion rookeries that are in the study region are included in special closures. There are some potential impacts to fishing here. Steamboat Rock is proposed as a seasonal special closure, again 300 feet around the rock, and is proposed to be closed from March 1st to August 31st. The South Cape Mendocino State Marine Reserve actually overlaps with the northern end of this special closure, so there is some overlap there. There are about 10,000 breeding seabirds that use this site, four different species. And again, there are some potential impacts to fishing with this special closure. Going south, Rockport Rocks. This is proposed as a 300-foot seasonal closure from March 1st to August 31st. And there are about 2,500 breeding seabirds that use this site of seven different species, with potential impacts to fishing and recreational abalone divers. And the colonies here really interact a lot with Viscano Rock to the south, so you'll see that's the final special closure, again proposed as a 300-foot seasonal closure from March 1st to August 31st. About 9,000 breeding seabirds here, seven species. And this is the one where you see that the special closure does not extend entirely around the rock, and that's because on the east side, even a 300-foot closure would extend up onto that beach. And the guidance from Department of Fish and Game is that special closure shouldn't have access from, you know, terrestrial access. So this is just from that eastern point of the rock and 300 feet around it. And there are potential impacts to sea urchin divers here. And that's it. Oops. Any questions?
All right, well, thanks for that, Dominique. If there are no questions or additions from the SAT, we are way ahead of schedule. It's now 3 o'clock. Do we want to knock off you want a break? Never mind. We're going to take a break. And what we will do, guess we're going to sit here and listen while I waffle and decide. Let's go ahead and there's public comment to follow, and I don't know if we want to take a short break and wedge birds and mammals in, or do we want to just take a long break? That's the question. Short break. Short break. Let's take 10 minutes break, and then we will come back and do birds and mammals, even if that pushes public comment back by a few minutes. Okay, thanks. Okay, while the rest of the science team comes back to the table, Ron wanted to talk about a book around his cookie.
I just want to put in a – there's a Mark Shargall who's done – I think this is his third – volume three of books that he's done on the MLPA process areas. And it just came out last week. Leave it up. Leave it up. Okay, I'm leaving it up. It's a beautiful book, and it's not just because I have a lot of pictures in it that I say that. It's really well done, and I highly recommend you guys take a look at it. I think some of the people back here have some other copies, too, if anybody wants to look at them. But I'll leave this one out for people to look at. Oops, there we go. Let me see if I can do this right. Yeah, I know. I'm trying to say, you know, everything's backwards. Yeah. This is in the ocean, you know.
Okay, so let's get back to the SAT agenda here. We're going to be moving into the evaluation results presentations. We're going to be starting with the birds, mammals evaluation and moving on through several other topics today. The one thing I wanted to bring up that's come up in various conversations is that, as Ken noted, in this region we have one proposal here in round three. And in past regions, we've had several proposals that kind of still give us a little bit of a gradient across various measures for context, for evaluating how different MPAs or MPA proposals go against one another. But here we're looking at one, and several of the presentations will be proposal versus the no action case. And here the no action case is basically there's nothing out there. And so recognizing some of the requests for the BRTF of really highlighting what's working, what's not, where we're close to guidelines, where we're not close to guidelines, and things like that are something we really want to have come out in these evaluations, simply because it is a network versus basically nothing, as opposed to a set of networks that can be examined for context. I believe that will come out in several of the several of the reviews as well. And with that, we're going to go ahead, and I'm going to turn it over to Ron, Craig, and Dawn. I'm not sure who's handling what, but there's going to be a presentation on marine birds and mammals. So take it away.
All right, I'll start with this and give the introduction. We'll be passing back and forth a little bit. There is one other photograph that I was going to put in here. I forgot to do it, so I'll just describe it to you right now. And that is of a bird, a puffin, with lots and lots of fish in its mouth. And I kind of want to bring out one of the things that we're talking about here today, and that is that, you know, as bird people, we know that birds and marine mammals eat a lot of the fish that most of you guys are really interested in. But it is important to understand and remember that this whole process is to protect, you know, complete ecosystems, and these high-order predators like birds and whales have some really important parts of the structure of these ecosystems, and we'll bring out some of that as we go along. So we I better not look at my screen because it's not moving the same. All right, we analyzed the proposal by looking at the breeding and resting and foraging activities of the birds. And as I told the Blue Ribbon Task Force last month, that kind of covers the life of the bird and marine mammals pretty well. We looked both at the proposal, the round three proposal, and the no proposal. And we looked at the two evaluations of the standard evaluation and the supplemental evaluation, which has been described to you. The marine bird analysis includes the state marine reserves, the special closures, which we'll talk a lot about, and then some state marine conservation areas. The marine mammal areas only considered state marine reserves and the special closures, so it was not included in the supplemental evaluations. We'll talk about that as we go on. At the breeding sites for birds, we look at the percent of the marine bird breeding populations that were protected in the bioregion. For marine mammals, we looked at the number of pinniped rookery sites protected. We looked at the protection of important marine bird breeding hotspots and important pinniped population hotspots. Those are things that we identified early on in this process. Here's an interesting, slide. The percent of bird breeding population there. I got a arrow there. Obviously, with no proposal, the proposal zero, the existing MPA, there's really not much to talk about there. For the basic North Coast proposal, there are very few of the breeding seabirds are included in that proposal. The supplementary proposal really doesn't change the photograph here at all, but when we get to the special closures, you see some major issues there. So that's why a lot of our attention has been to these special closures. And I want to point out two things here that are kind of important for us locally. If we look at the Brandt's cormorant, this light blue color or darker blue color right here, in which we're capturing about 50% of the breeding population in the special closures, and then also the western gull. I know most of you don't think much about gulls, but that's what I did my thesis on, and notice that we're up almost to 50% there. The reason I point these two out is because almost 50% of the world population of both these species occurs between the Farallon Islands and Castle Rock, and so we form an important part of the protection of these two species. Some of the other species, like the fork-tailed storm petrel, this dark blue in here, and I think the tufted puffin, which we get fair numbers here, almost 50%, and the rhinoceros auklet are all species of special concern and have some other value to them as well. So I'm going to pass the marine breed birding hotspots. These are ones that we designated early on in this process, and you'll notice the special closure actually takes in a lot of the hotspots that we identified. The ones that it doesn't is False Cape Rocks, Flatiron Rock, and Green Rock. I think probably now is a good time for me to mention, follow up a little bit at what Dominique said in the introduction to this, that Green Iron and Flatiron Rock were not included in these special closures because they caused some problems for safety, especially for kayakers and small boat operators trying to get back if the wind came up in the afternoon and so on. But working with the California Coastal National Monument, these two rocks, which are both very important seabird rocks, will be closed to all foot traffic during the bird season. And so we'll actually get some protection, not directly as a part of this process, but indirectly as a result of this process. So that's good. And then for the marine mammal rookeries, I'm just going to pass it on to Dawn, and then just let me know when you want to go to the next slide, Dawn.
Okay, thanks. So for the marine mammal rookeries, we've highlighted a number of areas that were hot spots. And for the North Coast proposal, you can see that they didn't capture any stellar sea lion rookeries in SMRs, and did capture a few harbor seal rookeries. But in special closures, the significant result here is that the two stellar sea lion rookeries were captured by special closures. And that's significant in that these are the two of the more southern rookeries of the stellar sea lion, and they're a threatened species. The harbor seal rookeries, however, only three of those were captured there, and so for a total of five pinniped rookeries, which include the two Stellar and the three Harbor Seals. And so, again, it's significant in that it captures the two important Stellar rookeries, but it is less able to capture a majority of the Harbor Seal rookeries. We identified a number of hot spots, including Southwest Seal Rock and Sugarloaf Island, which are those two Stellar Sea Lion rookeries. And we also identified four different hot spots for Harbor Seal breeding areas. And only one of them was captured in South Humboldt Bay. So for the other analysis is looking at the protection at roosting and haul-out sites. And so instead of just the at birds that are breeding on the rocks or the seals and sea lions that are breeding on the rocks, how do these proposals protect animals when they're hauling out outside of the breeding time or roosting? And this investigated the number and size of brown pelican roosts as well as the percentage of study reason populations protected for pinnipeds. Ron?
Quickly, the brown pelican roost, it's the same story we saw in the previous proposals, that there are actually quite a few roosts, but they're scattered up and down the coast on a lot of small islands, and so it's difficult to capture very many of them, and none of them are really, really large like we find in other parts of the state. So we have captured in the special closures again and in the regular proposals 3 to 5 of these roosts.
If you look at the haul-out population, which identifies the California sea lions, the Stellar sea lions, and harbor seals, in the North Coast proposals, there are a few SMRs that were really proposed that impact pinnipeds. So you can see that those numbers are quite low. But the special closures do a particularly good job in benefiting the Stellar sea lion on their haul-out sites. But again, if you look at the harbor seal, you see that there's only a small percentage of the population that is captured or benefits from these special closures. California sea lions benefits increase over the proposal with special closures to some extent. So the third analysis is to protect near-colony Natsi foraging sites. And so, again, we first talked about the ways in which these proposals protect breeding and then went on to how they protect roosting and hauling out. And the final thing is how they protect foraging areas for both seabirds and marine mammals. So we investigated the amount of foraging area and number of animals protected in that sense.
I'm just going to go back two slides for a second to... Let's see, how do I do that? There we go. To note that we did leave the harbor seals kind of hanging high and dry there.
I forgot the pun, sorry, Ron.
Okay. So there's four species we're going to look at here real quickly with the near-colony foraging areas. And the common murres and Brandt's cormorants are both species that forage away from the rocks, away from their breeding islands. We call these things central place foragers because they always have to come back to a central place after they're foraging. You might think of them as yo-yos. They have to go out and come back and go out and come back. And so proposals do capture some of the foraging areas for both the murres and the Brandt's cormorants. Special closures do not add very much to that because the special closures are just really right around the rocks, and both of these species go out to sea. And so these protected areas are mostly involved with the SMCAs that are found, you know, out in the ocean instead of around the breeding rocks. And if we go to the next ones, the pelagic and pigeon cormorants and pigeon guillemot. Oops, that darn T gets off again. These are animals that forage very close to the shore, both along cliffs and along the rocks. And so you'll see a little bit higher percentage of their foraging area is
is included in these proposals. Not much in the special closures because, for the most part, they don't breed on the big rocks. They breed, you know, on little tiny rocks and on cliffs and stuff all along the coast. So we'll see a little bit more protection of the from the regular proposals than we do from the special closures in these two species.
So just a sort of reminder about how we identified foraging areas, we highlighted those hollowouts and rookeries and then put a 3-mile buffer around those. And that's what you see on this figure here. You see those light areas surrounding the little red seal shapes. And those are the foraging areas that we've identified, again, as in a 3-mile radius around the rookeries and the hollowouts. And I just wanted to sort of show you this slide to show that there's a significant amount of foraging area we've identified for harbor seals, but only about 1.5% of the harbor seal foraging area was actually captured in SMRs in the North Coast study region. So I just wanted to highlight that for now. The Stellar Sea Lion near colony foraging areas. Again, there's just two colonies, two rookeries up here, and if you draw a 3-mile radius around there for their foraging area, you see that a little bit more is captured in SMRs in the study region. But obviously there's just one point up. I don't have a pointer, but can you point to the Southwest Seal Rock and then Sugarloaf down down south? For near college colony foraging areas, then we end up with a weighted foraging area index. And again, this is best used to sort of compare between studies. And so these numbers are kind of difficult to interpret when there's just a number there. But what you see is that this number incorporates both the foraging area and the number of animals that are in that foraging area. So you have a weighted foraging area index, but it's difficult to interpret without a metric to measure it by or compare it with. But you see that there is some small component of the foraging areas that are accounted for with this proposal. Neritic foraging analysis was accomplished, was analyzed by looking at sea surveys and identifying where those hot spots were for both seabirds and marine mammals. And I'll let Ron talk about what those analyses are for the birds.
Right. For the birds, it's really not a lot different from our previous proposals that we were looking at. The species diversity stays the same pretty much throughout the system. There's more square miles if we use the supplementary proposal. And the average number of animals sighted, which kind of gives you an indication of how much these are being used, is there. I don't know what else to say about that, really. It's difficult. I'm going to let Craig. Yeah, go ahead, Craig.
Yeah, I'll chip in on the neritic foraging. It is inherently difficult to analyze because the bird groups were separated that way because they have different marine habitat use patterns, and so hot spots for one group differ from those from another. But what you see up there is that in the supplementary analysis captured some hot spots for all four groups, the grebes and scoters, guillemots and pelagic cormorants, threatened marbled murrelets, and then all other seabirds combined. And that was largely because of the pyramid point. When it's included in the supplementary, it has hot spots for those three species groups. And for marine mammals, there was all pinnipeds, that is all the seals and sea lions, had one area of hotspot area captured in the NCP. Of course, for marine mammals, only SMRs were included, and so the supplementary analysis wasn't included, and SMCAs were not included. Were they included, you would see a lot more hotspots being captured, at least for the harbor porpoise, with the Reading Rock and Samoa areas. So it's actually not quite as bad as it would look here. And as far as the NCRSG trying to design an array that captures hotspots, I would say that
it's just fortuitous if you overlap, because the distribution of these species at sea in hot spots is so diverse that there's no way to design MPAs around the foraging areas of these species. But this is a portrayal of what did end up getting captured in this proposal.
I'd like to elaborate on that a little bit with the next slide. So another way to identify neritic foraging areas for gray whales was by looking at areas along the shore where they've been concentrated through observations from shore surveys. And again, these small circles, the small circles up around Crescent City and Klamath and Trinidad, are areas that we've identified as hotspots of gray whale foraging behavior. And gray whales are becoming particularly significant in relation to conservation issues along the coast, in that there's growing evidence that this really is a small population of animals, and the ones that feed down south may, in fact, be separate from the larger migrating population. So as we speak, this is becoming a more topical issue. But as you see here, there were none of these areas were captured in any of the SMRs or in the special closures that we've identified.
Yeah, and I'll just add real quickly to that. And, you know, that up in the Bering Sea, where there are gray whales all over the place, approximately 70% of the breeding seabirds associate their foraging with foraging gray whales, just to indicate that, you know, even though whales eat this plankton that lives in the mud, they stir up a lot of stuff, and so they're actually a very important component of the ecosystem. Moving on to shorebirds, this will be a quick part because, of course, there's only one little segment of estuary that really captured much shorebird habitat, and that was that component down in southern Humboldt Bay, and that does allow waterfowl hunting. There's a minor advantage to the shorebirds during the non-hunting season, but frankly, it's not going to be a big difference there. So no major benefits in Humboldt Bay. Waterfowl analysis is no added benefits over the no proposal area, and there are some estuarine habitats that were included beyond Humboldt Bay. That's in the Ten Mile Estuary, Big River Estuary, and Navarro Estuary that Dominique did. These all allow waterfowl hunting and other kinds of recreation. So there probably is some advantage to having these things for birds, but it's not tremendous. So just in summary, I want to say that the North Coast proposal, the inclusion of special closure, provides key benefits for breeding and roosting shorebirds, seabirds. I mean, this is a big deal for us. We are lacking protection at Flatiron Rock, at Green Rock, but I've told you that kind of as a result of this process, that's going to be addressed. And if we remove the recreational uses that are associated with the accommodating the tribes, that would add the Pyramid Point SMCA, which includes a bunch of the nearshore and neritic hotspot foraging for different species groups, including the marbled murrelet and things like that. So a few proposed SMRs would benefit marine mammals. Don's done that pretty well. Sugarloaf and Southwest Seal Rock are good for the Stellar Sea Lions. The only real harbor seal breeding hotspot was at the Castle Rock Special Closure. Like I said, we left the harbor seal out to dry a little bit, and not much in the way of benefits of gray whales and harbor porpoises. So I think this is the same slide I showed in the round two, and I think there's nothing different here about that. So we've got the seasonal closures and same thing I said last slide, so I'll go on. We did put a summary table up for birds, and noting again that all the really big, strong pluses are over here for special closures for the seabird colonies and roost sites and seabird breeding hotspots. Little happening outside of that in any of the proposal. And then, Dawn, if you want to finish up.
Yeah, and this is pretty self-explanatory. So in terms of the benefits for marine mammals, the pinniped hotspots overall has minimal benefit, and that's largely due to the inclusion of the stellar sea lion hotspots in the special closures. But in relation to protection at haulouts for the other pinnipeds or foraging for pinnipeds or gray whales or harbor porpoise, there are little to no benefits provided.
And just to finish up, we have one more slide that I'll show to the Blue Ribbon Task Force, and that I'll finish up with. I'm not sure I'll use a gull or a pelican, looking directly at them, and kind of state that this is something that as this process goes on, and as the adaptive management and evaluation of all these different things go on, I think we will be watching the future of these things like harbor seals and like seabird neritic foraging and things like that, because we do feel that these are important components of the structure of the ecosystem. So. That's it.
All right. Thank you, marine mammal and bird folk. Are there any questions or comments from the science advisory team? What lies before us is considering approval of this presentation and the supporting documents to go forward to the BRTF. So if there are any comments. If not, then we need the whole motion process to go ahead and approve that. Larry has moved. Steve has second. Dominic has thirded. So before we take a vote on this, we will invite public comment. In this case, we're running just a slight bit over our intended time for general public comment, so I'd like to invite public comment specific to the bird and mammal evaluation right now, and then we will have, after we finish this order of business, we'll take public comment on a more general range of topics. So is there any comment locally for birds and mammals? From the two nodes?
No comments from Crescent City.
Thank you.
We have two or three comments from Fort Bragg.
Okay. Specific to birds and mammals?
Yes.
Okay. Please proceed.
This is David Gurney in Fort Bragg, and I want to know what kind of protections are being put into place for whales and dolphins and other marine mammals in regard to the Northwest Training Range Complex. That's going into effect. In fact, public comment ended yesterday, unless it's been extended. But I haven't heard any mention of whether these marine protected areas will indeed be protecting marine mammals and birds from the Navy's operations. I mean, I'm talking about specific language put into the MLPAI regarding this issue. Thank you.
Thanks.
Next speaker is Gabriel Moroni.
Gabriel Quinn. I, too, also wanted to address the Northwest Training Complex region and how, if you guys have assessed and possibly could assess how this military training is going to affect the marine life. Also regarding tribal member use, just a little history, if we wouldn't have taken tribal member recreational use out of the picture, I think things would have been fine, since the beginning and before America was engendered. you really lack the understanding of how traditions and the balanced relationship with nature is very important, how this actually adds protection. Also, you seem to lack the understanding that by removing the fishermen, which also create a protective barrier from bigger industries, I want to see an assessment of how perhaps these fishermen can be protecting the environment, being able to tend to the marine life also. So again, military testing, don't see it being addressed. Also, the language that good old Skip wanted to put forward with the protection against oil drilling, natural gas, in my opinion, geoengineering needs to be added All these things don't seem to be addressed by the scientific committee. Please look into this. Thank you.
This is Jim Martin with one final comment about, you know, the. I think the analysis you did was pretty good, except for identifying what the gaps really are from existing federal laws like the Marine Mammal Protection Act and their contributions to the goals of the MLPA. There's actually a five, you know, a buffer zone around each cetacean in the ocean. You know, fishermen know that. And I think that when you write up, this item is a little related to the special closures because you get most of your scoring on the proposal from the special closures. So I think it's, you know, as important to reach out to the non-fishing community about what these regulations are. I think that if this just shows up in the fishing regulations, it isn't going to do much good. So that would be my comment.
All right, thanks. Jim, that's everybody from Fort Bragg then?
That's it from Fort Bragg.
All right, thank you. Any further SAT discussion prompted by any of that? In that case, we will...
Eric, if I can just do a quick check with Don. I just want to check because it might be an edit for when this goes up to the BRTF meeting. In the last slide, the round three summary table for the mammals, I noticed that there's no protections shown for stellar sea lion haulouts. And slide 11, which is the bar graph for percent of haulout populations under special closures, has ballpark 50-51% for, I think, stellar sea lions. I might be looking at these wrong, but I just wanted to get a double check for the final presentation.
Can we put those, which presentation is that? Let's get that presentation back up, remember one, so that we can actually look at those and clarify.
Yeah, it's G1, and it'd be slide 11, and then the last slide in the presentation. There you go. So I, looking at the red bar for the special closures under stellar sea lion haulouts, and then if you just shoot down to the last slide of the presentation, AGP, that'd be great. If you can just shoot down to the last slide, then. And again, I might have been looking at it wrong, but I just want to just make sure we get it fixed if it needs to be.
No, I think you're right, Jason, that we did omit some pluses there in the summary slide.
Yeah,
26.
Just some edits, that's all.
Slide 26 is for
stellar sea lion haulout. Okay, thanks. Yeah.
Okay, so then we're basically approving the presentation with the additional appropriate pluses to match up with the bar graph. All right. And can we have a show of hands approving the presentation and the analysis? Show of hands objecting or not approving, and a show of abstentions. And then, Steve, did you want to register a vote?
I'm for it.
Okay, good. great. All right, so
okay.
Thank you for it. We're now finished with the review and approval of the evaluation for marine mammals and marine birds. We're now going to have a period of public comment, general to any topic that the SAT touches on. Can we get the various cards to Ken? And Ken, you can run this, please.
Stephen Coleman, followed by Brianna Fraley, Bill Lemos, and Judy Trumper, who has some time ceded to her. Those are the four we have right now. And then we'll have to talk about to the nodes so maybe they can the You're queuing them up. Okay. So, Stephen, why don't you go ahead?
Okay. Thank you. My name is Stephen Coleman, Environmental Director for the Wiat Tribe. And just a few general comments here as you're evaluating the Round 3 proposal. I would like you to please think of treating the guidelines as guidelines, not laws, and remembering that they are guidelines that were developed not with this region specifically in mind. They're somewhat arbitrary guidelines. While the proposal that was put forth by the RSG was developed with this region in mind and with the specific considerations of the potential impacts. And in talking about the guidelines, just in some of the ways where they don't actually fit our region, I wish something like this, the MLPA, could come in and do a study of what the problems are before trying to force a solution onto something and just look around and like, oh, here we have a solution. Where can we put it? Instead of looking at maybe the problems with our fisheries up here have nothing to do with overfishing, that there's upstream impacts to the fisheries that have a lot more effect on the level of our fisheries, that the guidelines didn't even consider the existence of tribes and tribal uses, which have been here for thousands of years before there was the United States here. The guidelines are very flawed from that. That the spacing guidelines and the replicant guidelines seem to have little to do with this region. And so just, I mean, I know that you're not responsible and there's no way to change the guidelines now, but just saying to maybe keep that in mind. And then just one other general comment about considering the unintended consequences of something like this. I know we all want to protect our marine habitats and our marine fisheries, but is potentially destroying a sustainable fishery going to do that? Or would that maybe encourage more farmed fishing, more factory fishing outside of the 3-mile zone? So just remember that there are unintended consequences to stuff like this, too. Thank you, and thank you for your work.
Thank you, Stephen. If you'd come up behind Brannon, and we'll be followed by Bill Lemos and Judy Trumper.
Good afternoon, everybody. I'm back at the Wiat Tribe. I just had a baby, and
excuse me, that was
really
my fault. That was my fault. I'm sorry. It's a new toy up here, and Ken is learning to play with it. Brianne, go ahead, and congratulations on your...
My new addition.
Your new addition.
The newest Yurok tribal member. So, once again, I'm the Tribal Heritage Preservation Officer and Cultural Director of the Wiat Tribe. I'm just getting back into the swing of things and to let you know that our presence is here and for you to remember where you guys are walking and to tread lightly on Wiat territory as this is their land that you guys are all visiting as we're all visitors here for the Wiat area if you're not Wiat. So I just don't really know what to say about the process. Just like what Stephen had earlier said that you guys aren't responsible for making up the rules, that they are flawed, that it's really hard to try and think that you guys can make up rules and laws for a sovereign nation that has jurisdiction on their people and that expands the breadth of the tribal reservation boundaries, that ultimately the only people responsible for the Wiat people are the Wiat tribal government. So that just includes all the areas that are being talked about. I really don't know what to say. I wasn't intending to come up here to say anything, but I thought that it was important that the Wiat people are remembered in this process, that you guys are here on their territory, and that that needs to be ultimately respected. And that's the only thing that I can think about saying is that just respect and know where you guys are, that you guys are in Wiat territory, that it matters to know that and to remember that, even if it's not really going to change the process, just remember and keep that in your minds. Thank you.
Thank you, SAT, for this opportunity. My name is Bill Lemus. I'm a co-lead NCRSG member from Mendocino. I was recently reading a book called The Wave by Susan Casey, and something she says when she's doing her research for her book, she went to Hawaii, and she's got her conversation with a number of scientists on waves and wave theory, and she comes up with this concept that says the universe is not only stranger than we imagine, it's stranger than we can imagine. And that's sort of where we are right now, because I'd like to speak to the issue of how this language got changed into something different during the process that the RSG went through. In our design for our proposal, in the RSG motion, we state, and this is in every single one of the MPAs, this is included in all MPAs, conservation areas as well as reserves, all California Indian tribes, traditional non-commercial fishing, gathering, and harvesting for subsistence, ceremonial, or stewardship purposes, will be uses that are exercised by California tribes and tribal communities. That was our intention. Our intention is, and was, to allow all tribal use in all MPAs. So I don't know how that got changed so that SMRs don't allow tribal use. Our intention was to allow for that. And this changes things quite a bit. It changes things for the people who sat at that table and worked out this agreement. Now, we understood that we can't allow that under state law. We understood that. But it was the intention that our recommendation go forward with the intent that we support tribal subsistence ceremonial uses. We did it from the beginning, and we're doing it now. And it wasn't just me that remembered that. I checked with every one of the RSG members that are here, and that's what they all told me. We want to allow for tribal use in all MPAs. We know that can't happen, so we did what we did best. We talked about it, and then we moved it to the next level of discussion, which is you. So I appreciate all the knotty problems that are involved with this. But I think what we're hoping you can do is just strip away tribal use and evaluate the proposal that we put on the table as if tribal use was not there, so we can see how it performs, and then go from there, with our intention being that tribal use is allowed in all MPAs. Thank you.
Judy?
Yeah. Hi, I'm Judy Trumper with Pacific Rim Seafood in Fort Bragg. The California Sea Urchin Commission requests that the SAT review and endorse to the BRTF the adaptive management research proposal previously submitted. The CSUC has long supported the principles of adaptive management and co-management of MPAs consistent with the MLPA to provide marine resource and fishery managers real-world science data critical to making informed and sound policy decisions. We believe the research protocol suggested by Drs. Dixon and Schroeder will contribute to the success of the MPAs and should be recommended as the basis for studying the commercial harvest of sea urchins and its effects on other species of marine animals and algae. We believe the current science in this area does not meet acceptable standards to support sound policy decisions. We are confident that this proposal and the resulting data will go a long way to remedy that situation. Our proposal is to establish an MOU between the DFG, the MPA Monitoring Enterprise, and the CSUC to do the following. One, using the Dixon-Schroeder design, jointly choose an MPA suitable for this research. Two, CSUC divers with supervision by the DFG and ME gather baseline data and survey the study areas. Areas will have replicate harvest and non-harvest control blocks. Three, CSUC divers who gathered the baseline data will harvest the test areas using current urchin size limits. Four, after harvest is completed, divers will resurvey the test harvest area. Five, at 6 and 12 month intervals, divers will resurvey the entire area, study area, harvested and non-harvested blocks, and analyze data by comparing response variables. Six, duplicate this research in the MLPA North, Central, and South Coast study regions, including the Northern Channel Islands, in order to compare findings in different bioregions. Seven, use the results of the experiment to determine when and if sea urchin densities reach a level suggesting they should be harvested within MPAs to maintain the general health and utility of the ecosystem. Eight, all project data and analysis will be shared with parties to the MOU. Sea urchins can either be valuable resource, I'm almost finished, or destructive pest. Establishing and maintaining the proper balance between urchins and other marine life is essential for the success of MPAs and the sustainability of related fisheries and the other marine life. Thank you for considering our request on behalf of the CSUC. Sincerely, Tom Trumper, Dave Rudy, Bob Bertelli, and Harry LeCornick. Thank you.
Thanks, Judy. We've got two final speakers here in Eureka, John Corbett and Jennifer Savage, and then I understand we have four in Fort Bragg. So, John, if you'd come forward.
Hi, John Corbett, Yurok Tribe. First, I want to thank the science panel. I'm sure you don't get enough thanks for the incredible number of hours that you've done in coming together, and so I want to make sure that doesn't get lost in the comments here. I do think you have, if you've noticed, a tremendous agreement between this particular proposal. Now, the Yurok Tribe is, of course, reserving all rights. In other words, we're not waiving legal rights into the proposal. But there is a tremendous amount of community support that was very hard fought to get. Generally, on the process, the two biggest flaws I see, which are this a little bit more generic, is one, I think your method of estimating recreational take results in bizarre numbers. And I don't know whether you've done the calculations, but basically, if you follow it, 2 million sport licenses, you ignore every survey that ever occurred in the history of fish and game that say, gee, you know what? There's more fishing in Southern California. That's because of the weather, the population, and so on and so forth, to have that they will go wherever the resource is. And you come up with 365 million tons of mussels a year are harvested. And if I was the science panel, I would not want my name on that figure. It's not plausible. By comparison, the entire commercial catch in New Zealand is about 70. That's about 22% of the entire world commercial mussel market. So I think your current method of projecting recreational use is flawed, and you needed some way to modify it. We are willing to work with you to keep the lope and modify it, but we can't get in the door. The second fundamental challenge that I think you face is the Yurok Tribe supports a data-driven approach. And so we've gone out and we've done 10 surveys within our ancestral territories in the intertidal area, and they show a very different picture than what is shown in this room. And I think ultimately science has to be willing to admit the facts and admit the data and compare it and make slight modifications to what you're doing to make it work scientifically. Thank you for your time.
That new toy. Hi, Jennifer Savage. I'm with Ocean Conservancy. First of all, thank you for all your hard work. I know this has been a very challenging process. As a regional stakeholder group member, I just wanted to reiterate what Bill said. Our intention has always been to do what we could to ensure that traditional tribal use continues. Because we lack both the authority and the framework to do so, we've only been able to state and restate our intention, which is to allow all non-commercial tribal use in all MPAs. I know it makes things more complicated. It makes them inconsistent. It makes them even contradictory. We did the best that we could do with what we had to work with. Hopefully the policymakers and the regulators can resolve this at a higher level, but just for now I wanted to correct the record as far as what the stakeholder intent was. Thank you.
So I think we have some folks in Fort Bragg, and Jim, if you could cue them up and bring you on, I believe.
Yeah, I can. Actually, we have Linda Perkins, who has ceded time to Hawk Rosales. That's okay.
So Hawk will have 3 minutes, correct?
Okay. Hawk, you want to go?
Gentlemen, I need more than 3 minutes, and I need about 4 minutes. Only in the MLPA is 2 plus 2 equals 3.
No, when we cede time, we don't cede to full time. We cede a minute for each card. If you have another card, we can go to 4, Hawk.
Well, I'll cede another minute.
And who was that?
Jim Martin.
Okay, Jim, great. So we'll set Hawk at 4 minutes. Thank you, Jim.
Hawk Rosales, Executive Director of the Intertribal Sinkhorn Wilderness Council. The Intertribal Sinkhorn Wilderness Council wishes to thank the members of the Science Advisory Team for their efforts and commitment to working with the tribes in the North Coast region to design MPAs that protect our precious marine environment while recognizing and incorporating tribal uses. We believe that together we can find a way to protect tribal uses and meet the conservation goals of the Marine Life Protection Act. In August, the Intertribal Sinkhorn Council prepared a proposal to ensure the continuation of tribal, traditional, non-commercial gathering, harvesting, fishing, ceremonial, and other cultural uses of the Council's 10-member tribes in the North Coast Study Region. On August 15, we formally requested that the MLPA staff distribute our proposal to you and to the members of the Blue Ribbon Task Force and the Regional Stakeholder Group. We hope you received and have had the chance to review it. Our proposal has 3 parts. 1, an explanation of the strong conservation rationale behind the proposal. 2, a brief analysis of the principles that support recognition of tribal non-commercial uses. And 3, suggested revisions to the proposed MPAs. We will continue to urge that our proposed modifications and revisions be incorporated into the initiative's final recommendations to the Fish and Game Commission. Since time immemorial, traditional tribal uses have been and continue to be necessary for the very survival of North Coast tribes. These uses are not recreational or commercial. They are culturally unique to the tribes because they are essential to the lifeways and identity of this region's first people. Traditional tribal uses are grounded in ancient stewardship principles, help promote and maintain biological diversity, and are necessary for a healthy and biologically diverse marine ecosystem. Increasingly, Native peoples' traditional ecological knowledge, TEK, is gaining recognition by the global scientific community, especially among those progressive scientists who wish to understand and apply more successful models of integrated natural resource management. For your purposes today, we would like to focus attention on one particular aspect of our proposal. With regard to the Vizcaino SMCA, we propose creation of a 1,000-foot wide shore-based ribbon in which the gathering of marine resources would be allowed only for tribal members. The regional stakeholder group has declined to adopt our approach, preferring instead to permit tribal uses in common with non-tribal uses throughout this SMCA. We believe our proposal has merit, and we ask that the Science Advisory Team evaluate this ribbon approach as one option for addressing tribal uses. The ribbon approach to exclusive tribal uses is consistent with the conservation goals of the Marine Life Protection Act. It would reduce the number of people using the nearshore area and leave unaltered the level of protection applicable to the remainder of the SMCA beyond the 1,000-foot boundary. In addition, because impacts from tribal use would be less than those of the general public, a higher level of protection could be assigned to the nearshore ribbon area.
In its Round 3 Unified MPA proposal, the regional stakeholder group intended to design a system that does not prohibit or alter traditional non-commercial tribal uses in the marine environment. On August 31, the RSG adopted an important motion regarding tribal uses within the MPAs, which recommends that appropriate language be included in the regulations specifically identifying tribal uses as a distinct and separate category from the uses of the general public. We could not locate this approved tribal use motion in the list of briefing documents for today's SAT meeting. If it, in fact, is not included, we would like to know why, since it would seem that the SAT members should be familiar with this important decision by the regional stakeholder group. For the record, our council and the tribes of this region are opposed to the Navy's proposed expansion of the Northwest Training Range Complex, which, if approved, will result in irreparable harm to our marine ecology, specifically the death of hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of sea mammals. We think that the SAT and the other MLPA bodies should be made aware of, become familiar with, and should be opposed to this proposal. In closing, we urge that the science advisory team continue evaluating the full range of options, including nearshore tribal use ribbon areas, for designating tribal uses as a separate category distinct from the uses of the general public. We appreciate your consideration of this important matter.
Gabriel Quinn, again with the thank you for all your hard work, by the way. I echo the sentiment. I wanted to bring up this Navy testing. The comment period has been extended to October 24th, and they have asked for a permit to take and essentially maim or kill 36 different species. And it is estimated in the millions, over 11 million. So I would suggest that perhaps the scientists on this advisory team would consider commenting, if not already done. I echo the sentiment of Bill Lemos and others who support the sovereignness of the tribal members. But I also wanted to bring up something that most people don't bring up, and that's that all people have a tradition. And I myself am part of a tribe and tradition that also uses medicine from the ocean, that also has religious ceremonies from the ocean, that also gains our food from the ocean. Perhaps it is true that my genetics haven't been in this area as long, but I would also ask you to consider that when it comes to religion and it comes to tradition, this is something we all have if we understand our own family ancestors. This is something I understand well because I'm a practicing alchemist, and our tradition goes back since before the written word of the Garden of Eden, where Adapa, as you call him, Adam, was actually the first fisherman king. And if you look at our written history from pre-ancient Sumeria, it all starts with an explanation of honoring the ocean and honoring the act of gathering marine life. So please understand that this is not something that one people's practices, and this should be afforded to us all. Thank you.
Hello, Doug Hammerstrom, Mayor of Fort Bragg, and I, too, have been listening at your thoughtfulness and want to thank you for your efforts in this. And ever since the discussion of the questions and the issue in question six about how do specific factors of the North Coast affect your evaluations, I've been contemplating that question, and I don't know if you're going to do further work on that. I would encourage you to, either within this process or in your scientific lives outside this process, because it seems like we do really need to understand how the local environmental conditions, the weather, and how the access restrictions, and rocks in the ocean, being out there in the storm with those rocks around affect what the actual fishing effort is. And maybe with more understanding of that, we would be able to come up with more tailored regulations that wouldn't make people feel like they're being regulated when they don't need to be. So I specifically would ask you, given the lack of that kind of specific knowledge to in making your scientific evaluations, particularly on items J and K of your agenda, in phrasing what you have to say to the Blue Ribbon Task Force, have some restraint because of those knowledge limitations.
I think we just...
Are they able to hear us?
Yeah, they are able to hear us.
Okay, we just lost you, so hold your comment there for a moment.
We're just going to call you back. Any other public comments up here as we're in this wonderful transition stage?
I believe they're back on.
We believe they're back on. Fort Bragg, can you hear us? Give us one more moment, Fort Bragg. Can you call Jim, please? Oh, that's a good point, because of the delay. Yeah, the conversation should be... Oh, that's a fantastic noise.
Oh. Hello.
Hi. Sorry about that.
Yeah, we have one more.
Does Doug want to finish his thoughts?
Oh, I guess...
Did I get cut off?
Is that okay?
Yeah. So I don't know where I got cut off, because I wasn't aware of getting cut off.
I can tell you where.
Okay.
It was just right after you said things about taking into account the weather, rocks, and being out there with the rocks and their effects on fishing and their implications on J&K.
Okay. Yeah, so and just one story about that. Last week, the Board of Supervisors and the Fort Bragg City Council had lunch together, and Jim Martin joined us, and all of us landlubbers are commenting on, or actually gushing over what a wonderful day it was, and Jim looks out at the ocean and says, gee, it's awful windy out there. Nobody'd go out with a boat. So even on our great days, fishing doesn't happen. We really need to understand more about what the limitations are in this environment and how those limitations provide natural protection for the fish. And we need to understand more, what do the fish do when it's windy? Does it stir up food? Do they feed? Are they getting fat and happy while the fishermen aren't able to go out? And when the fishermen are able to go out, they're just laying on the bottom all fat and happy. So anyway, and so I just wanted you to recognize the broad discussion that the regional stakeholders had and keep in mind that they resolved a lot more conflicting issues than what you're resolving in your discussions, and just in how you word your comments to the Blue Ribbon Task Force in relation to your agenda items J and K, just keep some humility in relation to that, in relation to the fact that we really need more knowledge about our area to be stronger as a scientific determination.
Hello, can you hear me? Are they?
Yes.
Yeah, are you there? Okay, can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Go ahead.
This is David Gurney in Fort Bragg. I want to respectfully submit that at the August Regional Stakeholders Group meeting, during the special closures that were discussed in the last hour and a half or so, no public comment period was offered in the round three. So I think that was a requirement, and you failed to meet that requirement. And I want to ask a question that got me arrested in April, namely, where in your reporting or recommendations regarding these marine protected areas is there any mention of the Navy war training? Where in the reporting or recommendations are there any mention of wave or wind energy installations? And how about fish farms? Are these considered extractive uses? And what about oil exploration? Although that's not extractive, I have not heard anything mentioned about that. So I want to know what kind of protections are being put in place with these science guidelines. So far, I've heard nothing. We've been asked to accept the best available science, but what we need is the best science available, and that's not what we're getting. I'd like to know, with a show of hands in that room, who in the room is being paid wholly or in part by the Resources Legacy Fund Foundation, and who of you will profit by grants and research within the marine protected areas if and when this thing goes through. Regarding tribal uses, is it legal to pass regulations based on possible pending legislation? I don't think it is. It doesn't make much sense. I support subsistence gathering not only for the tribes, but for all local coastal residents. And I feel anything less is racist, frankly. I feel we need to support and create sustainable fisheries for tribes and local residents of the North Coast. As someone said earlier, why fix it if it's not broken? We already are shut down. Our fisheries are basically shut down on the North Coast. We have no fisheries. When I go to the supermarket to buy some lingcod or red snapper, it's coming from Canada. And we have lots of fish right offshore here. Why aren't we allowed to touch it? This, I think your science is basically, to put it bluntly, junk science. You really don't know what's out there, and you're closing down fisheries that don't exist. And you're not dealing with other issues beyond what we've talked about here, namely global warming, ocean acidification, the Pacific trash gyre. Why aren't these issues being discussed if you're actually ethical scientists?
David, you need to wrap up. Time is up.
I think we need to wrap this up, but I'm done. Thank you.
That's all the public commenters we have from Fort Bragg.
Thank you, Jim.
Are we wrapped up then, Ken? Okay, great. All right, thank you to the folks in Fort Bragg and to the folks locally who provided public comment. Notes were taken, and all that stuff will be taken into consideration as appropriate. We are now at 4:18. Wow, we are like right on time. We're 2 minutes. Well, actually, we're a whole agenda item ahead. We're going to move on to item H, where Dominic will provide us a review of the application of the water quality evaluation methods to the North Coast. So
do we have the clicker? Okay, thanks, Eric. So I'm going to present the water and sediment quality evaluation for round three. If I can figure this out. Is there a different button? Tried to do that. The left button. Okay. The infamous left button. So just to go over the water quality guidance, which is also in the evaluations document, we recommended originally and still do that that we encourage the co-location with state water quality protection areas. So If MPAs are established and they're established in areas that are now state water quality protection areas, they would get protection in terms of water quality. And that term, state water quality protection area, includes a special subset, which are areas of special biological significance. And the ASBSs are the only state water quality protection areas now. And so those are sort of interchangeable throughout the rest of this presentation. We also recommended avoiding, where possible, areas of water quality concern. Those would include urban stormwater and non-point sources of pollution. And you'll see there we were very optimistic about today's earlier vote, and we had already included in the dredge disposal sites. And then also wastewater point sources, and we had different categories, major sources, intermediate sources, and minor sources with different buffer zones. And so the proposals up until this point and including this round have been broken down into two categories. We have MPAs that are proposed in embayments. Bays and estuaries are more likely to be associated with stormwater runoff, which to some degree is natural and does provide nutrients, but also it can contain pollutants as well. None of the embayments in the state have ASBSs, and so that's the difference between those areas and the coastal MPAs. Coastal MPAs include the coast and any offshore rocks and islands. And the large ASBSs that are found in the North Coast do provide a lot of opportunities for co-location. So we had different scoring methods in the evaluation document. And in embayment MPAs, if you did the worst job in terms of locating with a variety of water quality problems, you would get the least desirable score of a 0.25. So that's the worst you could get in an embayment MPA. A score of 1 is the most desirable. So that's the range from 0.25 to 1. And that would have no water quality concerns in a 1. For the coastal MPAs, the least desirable score is 0.17, and that would have serious water quality concerns. A 0.67 is a favorable result, indicating no water quality concerns. If an MPA were co-located with an ASBS, it could get all the way up to a 1, which is the most desirable score. And these are weighted averages for each proposal. I didn't go through all those details here. But it's a calculation that's performed where we get these results. See if I went too far here. Yeah, I think we're okay. So this is a comparison with Proposal 0 and the North Coast proposal, and you can see there's no comparison. There aren't any... there aren't any embayment MPAs in the current group of MPAs along the North Coast. And there's a 1, a score of 1, and that's because all of the embayment MPAs that were proposed had no water quality concerns in them. They're all in very clean areas. And then here's a comparison of Proposal 0 and the North Coast proposal for the coastal MPAs. And you can see there the symbols. So the diamonds, the yellow diamonds, are ASBSs. And the squares, the red squares, are stormwater discharge zones. And for Proposal 0, there was one MPA in an ASBS. But there's also one stormwater discharge zone that is in a current MPA. For the round 3 proposal, you can see that there are 3 MPAs located in ASBSs, and there are no water quality concerns. So for that reason, it gets a very good score. It gets a 0.76, And you could look at it in a little bit more detail here. I think there are 13 of these coastal MPAs that were proposed, and you can see where the ASBSs are co-located. They got ones, and then all of the others had no water quality concerns, so they got 0.67, as we talked about earlier in the evaluation methods. And so that's how they all break down in terms of within that proposal. And this is just a set of maps showing where the co-location with the ASBSs took place. So starting at about 11 o'clock, if we were to take this as a clockwise, take a clockwise approach to this map, you'd see Redwood National and State Park ASBS. You could see the Redding Rock SMR and SMCA. They're located either in or adjacent to that ASBS. Then going to 2 o'clock in the maps, you can see the King Range National Conservation Area ASBS, and that's actually that name has changed now. It's King Range ASBS, but it's the same area. And you can see the Sea Lion Gulch SMR and the Big Flat SMCA that are co-located there. Going to 5 o'clock, the Jug Handle ASBS is, it's actually a very small ASBS, as well as the Trinidad Head ASBS, which is at about 7 o'clock in our diagram, and neither one of those has a MPA proposed in them. But again, they're very small, so there's limited opportunity for that. They could have been placed there, but they weren't, and you know, it's kind of hard to hit a small target in some ways. So in terms of the summary for the PowerPoint presentation, the regional stakeholder group proposal did very well with all the MPAs avoiding all water quality concerns, including those dredge sites. The North Coast proposal did well at co-locating with ASBSs as well. And finally, and this is sort of a thing that I wanted to run by you all here at the SAT, the regional stakeholder group avoided placing nearly all MPAs near harbors, which is pretty common knowledge, which decreased the likelihood of co-locating MPAs with water quality concern areas. So the fact that they weren't around harbors or where the MPAs weren't proposed around harbors, you're going to avoid a lot of industrial issues there too. But that increased the probability of not meeting other SAT guidelines, such as size and spacing for certain habitats. So my point here is that it scored very well for water quality, but this is probably the main reason why. So it's worth mentioning. And then that's the end of the presentation, except for our, you know, every one of these water quality PowerPoints always has this mandatory statement on it that the water quality evaluations are not mandated by the master plan for MPAs and therefore should be considered secondary to the other guidelines. I'm going to mention one other thing really briefly, and that is the formal comparison we made was with Proposal Zero, but we did take a look at how the water quality guidelines work in a comparison between the round two proposals and the round three proposals. And we mentioned that briefly in the document that's associated with this. And I think it's on page, I think it's on page three of document H2. You don't really need to bring that up if you don't want, but I'm just going to read it really quickly. Scores were influenced by co-location with ASBSs and the number of MPAs proposed in a given proposal rather than co-location in areas of water quality concern. This proposal scored better than Proposal Zero, which I already mentioned had a weighted score of 0.54. Proposal Zero contains an MPA adjacent to McCarricker State Park, and that also had an urban
stormwater drainage area, which the proposal in this current round that avoided that. While not significant, this proposal had a weighted score of 0.76 for open coastal MPAs that is only slightly less than the two proposals from round two. And I'm paraphrasing a little bit here, but that included Sapphire 2, which had a score of 0.80. This is due to the higher number, and this is the important part, this is due to the higher number of MPAs proposed in the final proposal. While the water quality score for the final proposal may have been lower, in other words, 0.76, the overall protection gain by area is much greater when compared to round two proposals because the final proposal contained more MPAs without compromising water quality. So my point here is that if you just take the guidelines that we have for water quality and just blindly apply them, you know, there are a few holes or gaps in that method. And here, although it got a slightly lower score, it actually did a little bit better job in terms of water quality. So it's important, I think, just to mention that. Not this isn't really for the BRTF. This is just for the SAT that I wanted to mention this, that, you know, if we ever have to go through this again in another study area, it's something to consider. So that's the end of my presentation.
Thanks, Dominic. Any questions from the...
Dominic, I was just curious, why isn't the Humboldt Bay SMRMA get a score? It's not collated with an ASBS. Is that a precedent in this region, or has that been done in the past?
So the SMRMA in Humboldt Bay, that's in the South Humboldt Bay, right? I think it's because it was a SMRMA. I'd have to check the actual results. Let me do a quick check.
Hey, can you repeat the question? I'm confused what the question was.
No, it did get a score.
It says one, though.
For?
The figure in the presentation showed a score of one, a perfect score.
For all of the embayments.
Yeah, there was a perfect score for all embayments. So the South Humboldt Bay isn't one of our water quality concern areas. I think that's what you're getting at. I was wondering maybe if we didn't.
It's not an embayment?
No, I think that's correct.
The point is that since there are no ASBSs and those other things
right.
in embayments,
right.
it was not put into the denominator of the scaling factor.
That's
so
right.
It wasn't an automatic penalty because you never got one for estuaries. So estuaries had a slightly different scoring scheme, and
right.
that's why you can get a one
right,
in that.
ASBS.
Yeah. Is that correct, Dominic?
Yeah, no, that's right. I was a little confused because I was wondering maybe we didn't do the SMRMAs the same, but we did. I'm looking at the scores right now. And the entire proposal, including all the embayments, would get a one. And so that's borne out by the math there. And that's the reason why, because we had different two different categories. The embayments had different criteria.
Just so I can add to that, knowing the geography of Humboldt Bay, the location of the SMRMA is about the only place where you could put a MPA without having an outfall or water quality issues. So maybe it was intentional.
Can I ask a quick, you don't even have to answer this now, but I'm going to forget to ask you later tonight. Why are there no ASBSs in embayments?
The reason is because the ocean plan only covers open coastal waters. And for the water board, almost from the beginning, the ocean plan has been the main vehicle for designating ASBSs. There's nothing in the water code to say that they couldn't be established in an embayment. It's just because the ocean plan doesn't cover embayments. It's just that's de facto how it occurred.
Great. Well, then we need a motion to approve Dominic's presentation and the supporting documents so they can be forwarded to the BRTF.
Also move.
Great. We got that. Any public comment from here or our nodes regarding specific to the water quality evaluation?
John Corbett, not representing anyone but myself. There are also specific water quality code provisions that required special provisions for bays and estuaries where you can't discharge beyond the natural background receiving water, which is an exceptionally high standard. The discharges to Humboldt Bay have quite a long history, but were specifically decided by the State Water Resource Control Board and are fairly unique in the state.
Thanks for that.
You have reached the Delmar County
Office of Emergency Services. The note extension you are trying to reach, you can dial it at any time.
And we're gonna pick you back up in 2 seconds.
You have reached the Delmar County Office.
Okay, so let's go ahead and have a show of hands in favor of the motion to approve the presentation.
You have entered an invalid extension.
Any in opposition and any abstentions? No. Great. All right, so that's taken care of. Thank you very much. That brings us to the end of official SAT business for the day, but there is Ken and Melissa have things. Becky and Melissa have things to say, and Ken. I think Emily probably has a comment as well. Actually, let's go ahead and take care of that since it's fresh in our mind. Before you start, Melissa, thanks. Steve Murray is going to give us an update on the LOPs for intertidal seaweeds.
Yeah, I think we have this sorted out. I think what would be good if you could put the one slide up, because everybody will see this really easily, and it's the one that has the moderate, low, and low levels of protection in the groups that are in it. Yeah. So while that's coming up, you know, we discussed this with a little subgroup over here who have worked on the LOPs before. And, you know, what we're going to propose is a categorization that has some really minor shifts in it, but that, you know, makes it's consistent in terms of the way the algae are being treated with regard to LOPs. Okay, so first of all, you'll notice that in the moderate levels of protection, there's this group called turf algae. Then we go down to the low level of protection, the very bottom, and you see canopy-forming algae, you see the sea palm, you see bull kelp, you also see marine algae. So it's an addition of the marine algae category that I think kind of spurred this, because that's really everything else. So I think what we've agreed is that first, that with regard to turf algae, that we should replace that name, and it should be called sheet algae, simple sheet algae. And it should be limited to Porphyra and Ova. Okay. Then secondly, with regard to the marine algae in the very bottom in the low level of protection, we should move those algae up into the moderate low. And what we would say is that that category would now be called marine algae except for sheet and canopy forming algae. In other words, this is all the other algae. And this would include then Chondrocanthus, Gigartina exasperata, Mastocarpus, and all the other multiple hundreds of species that exist. So that would give us then sheet algae, which are very opportunistic in the way they grow back fast. And we've run these through the LOP, scheme. Okay.
Quick clarification. Steve, you said you would move the other marine algae up to moderate low. I believe, did you mean moderate or moderate low?
Moderate low.
Okay, and that's different from the sheet algae.
Yes.
Okay, good. Thank you.
Sheet algae or ulva and porphyra, they stay in moderate. Marine algae, except for sheet and canopy-forming algae, move up into the moderate-low category. That now includes Chondrocanthus, Chigartinus, Asperata, and Mastocarpus. And then the canopy algae continue to stay in the low. I believe that's what we've looked at.
One thing that I probably should have made sure was clarified while we're having this discussion is those general categories, marine invertebrates and marine algae, are not intended to be others not, you know, mentioned elsewhere on this. But if you were to propose that you wanted to allow take of all marine algae generically, then that would include both what were formerly called turf algae and the canopy-forming algae, and therefore your level of protection would be low. Likewise, for the marine invertebrates, that would include, you know, all of the marine invertebrates that are elsewhere listed on the list, plus some other things we might not have written down.
Okay.
So it sort of complicates it.
Yeah, it does.
a couple of comments. So you notice that down in the low, we actually identify specific species. In this particular case, sea palm and bull kelp. What I would suggest up in the moderate category, rather than making up a terminology like sheet algae, is because it's such a restricted number of species, we simply say ulva and porphyra.
You know, that's a perfectly satisfactory solution. You know, one of the problems you run into is that unlike a lot of fish and many of the invertebrates, there are no good common names. And so you wind up using the Latin names, and then you wonder what you communicate to the group. Mm-hmm. So, you know, given what Emily just said, let's table this and we'll come back and get it later, because we certainly didn't think of it that way, that those were catch-alls for simply everything that might be harvested. So let's table it. We'll come back to it.
Am I on? Yeah. That sounds like a great decision, because I would want to see it written down on the table before I could consider it anyway. Not that I know anything about algae, apparently, from my previous chatting. Okay, I think that takes care of business then for today, except for what's about to unfold. So I'll turn it over to Ken and Melissa. Maybe what?
No.
Okay.
Just do this one. Okay, Becky was here just a moment ago. This is the thank you part of the program, where we get to say thank you for all the service that you've done. Some of you have been here at this for a long time. In fact, we have actually one member here who started, you know, right after the law, and at the end of the table, Dr. Murray, and had to catch his breath, and then he did catch it and came back and joined us. And then some of those folks like Mark Carr and Steve Gaines and Astrid that have been here since the beginning of this initiative process. And, you know, I just am in awe of what you do. And I know I'll have Becky talk on behalf of the director who appointed all of you, but from the standpoint of initiative staff that I get to coordinate, I can tell you that one of the things that excites us the most about our jobs is these meetings and the kind of process that you go through, the kind of respect and civility that you show each other, and it's what really makes us feel good about what we do, and it is the core of what we do. So we are, as your staff, very grateful to have known you and appreciate so much what you do for us and what you have done for the state and I think the world in setting the right tone. And so for that, on behalf of staff, we're grateful. So on behalf of the really important people, I'll let Becky speak.
I've got this microphone.
Okay.
I'll use this mic. Ken stole some of my words, as usual. But I do want to reiterate what Ken has said. We all agree with that. And really on behalf of the director and John McCammon and Deputy Director Sankey Mastrup, who unfortunately couldn't be here, want to extend an incredible gratitude toward you for your service, and it's been very interesting all along the way for all of you to be here and in other regions, and the amount of time and effort that you put into this is just phenomenal. It'd be interesting to add up the hours to see how many hours you guys have spent. I wish we could give you more, but right now the state is not in a position to do more than what we have, although the gratitude and the thanks are endless, and that will go on for a very long time. Oh, I do want to remind you that you are on the hook until June of 2011, so we may come back to you, but that's an exciting thing for us, I believe. First, we'd like to just identify those of the SAT who are not here, and I just want to call them off by name because this gratitude extends to them as well, for sure. And first of all, Dr. Chris Costello, Kevin Fleming, Dr. Stephen Gaines. Did you mention Stephen had been here? Okay, good. Dr. David Henkin, Dr. John Largier. I thought I saw David. Dr. Philip Levine. Dr. Peter Ramunde. Dr. Stephen Rumrell. Sorry, Stephen. Dr. Astrid Schultz, who was going to be here and couldn't make it. Yeah, got as far as the airport. Yeah. And Dr. John Wilson White. So we really appreciate you two if you're listening, and your certificates will be in the mail. Okay? Okay. So for those of you who are here, we would like to present your certificates to you in person. So when I call your name, please come up. You can give me a hug if you want, but you don't have to.
No, I don't have to hug Ken.
No, you don't have to hug Ken. So, Dr. Larry Allen.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Larry.
Dominic Gregorio. Oh, yay.
Thanks, Doug.
There's two. Okay.
Dr. Dawn Goley.
Becky Dawn had to...
She's gone.
She had to go pick up her daughter, so she had to leave slightly.
Oh, I didn't get a hug from Dawn. Okay. We will give that to her. There you go. Dr. Stephen Morgan.
Dr. Morgan has a special continuing interest in what we're doing. As we're wrapping this up, his wife heads the Ocean Science Trust and overseeing the monitoring enterprise. So, you know, this will never stop at your house.
How exciting for you. Dr. Stephen Murray. Dr. Karina Nielsen. Craig Strong. Steve Wirtz.
And this is the supervisor in the workplace, too.
I wasn't going to say anything. But
I just wanted it was on film, Steve, and you were A-OK, right?
Yeah. And the last three we have are for our co-chairs. So Ron LaValle, please step forward. A very important job the co-chairs have. You're welcome.
Thanks.
Dr. Eric Bjorkstedt, who did all this with new family in tow, too. Thank you, Eric. Thank you. See, I knew everybody wanted hugs today. And last but not least, Dr. Mark Carr.
Give me a hug. Yeah, there we go.
In you, my dear.
And we turn it back to you, Eric. Thank you again, all of you, very much. Thank you.
So with that, I think we're officially done. Delbert, is there anything that we needed to tell SAT folks? Because...
Okay. Yeah. Okay, dinner tonight will be at Six Rivers Brewery in McKinleyville. I knew that would make you guys happy. Someone told me that in selecting a place. He said, where should we go? And that's, I'm happy. You guys are happy. Okay, so if everyone, dinner's at 7. I kind of hinted to them that we might show up around 6:30-ish. So feel free. We have a room set aside in the back like we did before. So I'll just see everybody there. If people would mind gathering in the lobby area to kind of carpool up there, that'd be great.
And we do, those who are at the tribal meeting will obviously will order dinner too, because you'll have some people.
We won't order until you get there. How's that sound? Fair? Okay, thank you.
All right, then we stand adjourned till tomorrow morning at, look at your agenda. It's 8:30. Yeah. Thank you.